This is The Program with Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Hands off, Jimmy! Don't touch Jimmy!
Social distancing in style from their homes and broadcasting live. Here's Andrew and Sat.
Hey, what's up? Happy Thursday. It's Andrew Walker. It is Satyar Shah. Also with us, Bick Nizar, our producer, and Justin Morissette, who is hanging out back at the Sportsnet 650 Vancouver studios. The isolation home shows continue in week three of this adventure that we call life. How are you guys? How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right.
Once again, I decided to wear clothes I would normally wear to work as opposed to just wearing sweatpants or shorts and make myself feel a bit more normal than usual.
You're like Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly in a tux going for the job interview in Step Brothers, basically.
Definitely not. It's the F-boy pants and a t-shirt. It's really not.
I think I can solve
that,
this whole pan dilemma. I am, full disclosure, I am not feeling it today. Woke up with a headache, and before I knew it was 4 p.m., I've just been, sweatpants, walking to the fridge, eating leftover pizza, going back to sleep. Not good. Yeah,
not good. Yeah,
not a good scene at the Walker House today.
Yeah, that's not a great feeling when you're getting up and feeling that way. So, what about you, Bick? Do you have a sense of normalcy right now? Are you doing okay?
Sure. No, not really. I'm keeping about my day, but nothing feels normal. I'm starting to get used to this being my new normal.
Yeah, this is our new reality, and I think we're adapting to it.
650-650 is the Subway text line. We call for texts all throughout the show because we have different things that we want you to get involved in if you're listening, and I'll get to some of those. But one of them, too, is I actually – we are here for you if you need to vent, and I really feel like we're getting into that mode in this sense, and I don't know if you guys see this. When this first started – and when people are like, all right, everything's shutting down and we're gonna stay at home and it's isolation, people almost approached it. And I don't think this was dumb or this was wrong, but I think a lot of people approached it as it was almost kind of fun, right? And it's like, all right, we're at home and let's be as productive as possible and I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna learn this skill and I'm gonna we got snacks and we're cooking and we're doing TikToks and that's fine and that's good, but no one can sustain that level of complete energy and productivity for that long. I think it takes a real special person, and so here we are. We're a few weeks in, and I think people are really starting to feel it, and it's going to go on for months. And you know why? It's because people max themselves out early. And they're like, look at all these activities, and I'm productive, and I'm going to, we got wine FaceTime nights and Zoom. And it's like, you just can't do that. You can't replace normal life with all these kind of, make busy projects. And I do think there's a lot of people starting to struggle with this being the reality. Because guess what? The isolation is not only going to continue. It's going to get more intense because – and we see all across the world and all across North America, those social restrictions. Like before, it's like, okay, I'm not going to go over to my friends tonight. That makes me a good person. Well, we're getting to the point where you are not allowed to do that, no matter what. It's not about being responsible. We're going to be talking about legal matters and fines, and it's only going to get more serious. I'm really starting to feel that from people.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, I think people are trying to have as positive an outlook as possible, right? I mean, what are you supposed to do? As opposed to being we're trying to do all these things to keep up our time and fill the void and try to stay active and stay social. I mean, you got to try to do something. You can't just sit at home and sulk, right? So you have to try. And after that, adrenaline kind of wears off the first few weeks because we're all kind of in this moment that none of us have been in. It's scary, but at the same time, excitement. And when adrenaline pumps, it gets you kind kind of the fear and the euphoria at the same time. So it's a weird vibe you go through. But as soon as that adrenaline is off, then you're starting to deal with reality and what's happening. And, yeah, I still think that the things you're trying to do early on to stay busy are the right things to try to double down on. But you have ups and downs day to day, right? Some days you feel great, and some days you really feel it.
Yeah, and I hear you. And I'm not trying to be critical of the people that were – you know, two nights in having like, oh, I got to see my friends and we're going to do a big conference call with wine nights. Like, is it a little much for day two or day three of quarantine? Maybe. But my point is, we always say this when analyzing hockey games, when a guy gets back from the injury, you know, Brock Besser was that example. What's the kind of the cliche? It's cliche, but it's true. You're not worried about a guy's legs or energy level the first night back from a layoff. You're just not, because adrenaline carries you through. But once you start getting into game three, game four, game five, like without fail, you're like, wow, that guy's a step behind. It's like, well, yeah, he's been off. He's been off for a while. Well, how come he didn't look bad in game one? Because he was going a mile a minute. And I think that's how a lot of people, you know, to use the sports analogy, have kind of been dealing with this whole thing. And now, and I'm no different. I'm no different. You know, one day starts to run into the next a little bit. And there's no end in sight and there's no outlet. It can be frustrating for people.
Yeah, there is an end, though. This will end. We just don't know when that is, and it's not going to be indefinitive into whenever. Like, there will be a time, several months down the road, when this will change and it will get better. It will get better. It's just we don't know when it's going to happen. But, you know, this won't continue forever. I think that's one thing to always remind yourself, is that this will have an end date. We don't know what that date is, but this isn't something that's going to drag on for 3, 4, 5 years or anything. Like, this will come to an end.
So this is what's happening on the show today. We're going to talk some NFL draft again, and NFL offseason. Matt Waldman's going to join us from the rookie scouting portfolio coming up after 4:30. Our buddy from out east, Justin Bourne from Sportsnet and Hockey Central at noon, is going to join us in the 5 o'clock hour. We'll do our daily check-in segment and the isolation mailbag in the 6 o'clock hour as well. If you have your questions you want us to answer, kick around, or have fun with, 650-650 is the Subway text line. Also, yesterday we did it for the first time, and I thought it went really well. We're going to do our shout-outs coming up 5 or 6 minutes before 7 p.m., of course, honoring our frontline health workers or somebody in your life that does deserve recognition. We had lots of submissions yesterday, but if you know someone that deserves a little bit of love on air, we'll give it to them. 650-650 is the Subway text line. Another thing I'd like to get to, I don't know if we'll do it right now. Maybe we'll do one sport right now. But we briefly talked yesterday about the first ever games that we attended. And everybody has their first. And I think for a lot of people, it was, even for us, it was like a huge first impression when it came to watching live sports. And especially when you're a kid, things like that make an impact. So I don't know if you found everything, but today I found the first, I did this yesterday, but I found that the box scores of the first baseball games I went to, Major League Baseball. I also found the box score of the first NHL game I ever went to, the first NBA game I ever went to, the first NFL game I ever went to, and the first CFL game I ever went to. The internet's an amazing place when you really get searching. So yeah, I have all that. Do you want to do? Do you want to talk about our first hockey games?
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay. So all right. So what was the first NHL game that you ever attended? Did you find it?
Yeah, I did, and it was at GM Place, October 23rd, 1996. It was just a few months after we had moved to Canada from Sweden and watched the Canucks versus the Colorado Avalanche. The Canucks lost 4-1 that night. Peter Forsberg had a goal and an assist, and I was a Canucks fan, and I wanted the Canucks to win, but part of me was happy seeing Forsberg score a goal and get an assist, to be honest.
And in 96, so that would have been the Avalanche Stanley Cup year.
Yes.
Yeah, they're for their first ever year. I found mine. Mine was, so I grew up in Saskatchewan, but a lot of my family was in Alberta, cousins and stuff. So judging by the date, this must have been when we had gone to Alberta for Christmas. So and while we were there, we went to see an Oilers game. So my first ever NHL game was December 29th, 1993. Now, if you would have asked me this yesterday, I would have said that the Montreal Canadiens beat the Edmonton Oilers 6-3. But in actuality, the Edmonton Oilers beat the Montreal Canadiens 6-3. I got the score mixed up. But yeah, it was a 6-3 Oilers win. The Habs came in 500, and the Oilers were not very good. They were 11-23-5. But 6-3, Patrick Waugh did not start for the Canadiens because the Oilers are so bad. So they played Red Light Rassico in net, and he went against Billy Ranford that night. But scoring for Montreal Canadiens, Brian Bellows had one, John LeClair had one in his rookie season, and Oleg Petrov had one. And scoring for the Oilers, how about this list of guys? Bob Beers had a goal and assist. Ilya Byakin had a goal and two assists. Dano Seager with one and one. Corson had a couple of points. Dave Manson scored a rare goal. And Vladimir Vojtech with two goals. First star of the night. And Billy Ranford made 42 saves for the win at Northlands Coliseum.
Vojtech, that's something, man. That is
I think that's how you said it. Vladimir Vojtech?
I think so. I don't think you're wrong. I think you're right. I think you're right on it. Yeah, that is hilarious. I did watch Patrick Roy go up against Kirk McLean that game, and he made 20 saves out of the 21 shots he faced to beat Kirk McLean. So, and the only goal scored by the Canucks was by Mike Sillinger. And I always wondered why I like Mike Sillinger so much. Maybe it's the fact that he's the first Canuck ever saw score a goal in person.
So Vladimir Vojtech played 6 years, 110 games in the NHL, scored 7 goals, and I saw 2 of them.
you saw the highlight of his career.
I saw like 29% of his NHL goals. Bick, what was your first NHL game?
My first NHL game would have been game four, 94, round one. So the Calgary Flames at Pacific Coliseum. They won 3-2, but Canucks had a 2-1 lead heading into that third period. And I remember Lyndon hit the post, I think with the net empty or on a power play late in the game.
Wow. So, you know the series had a good ending at least.
They were down 3-1 in that series and came back. So,
that would have been the 3-1 game.
Yeah, that's the 3-1 game. Yeah, that was a low point of the series.
It felt like it was over. I like have memories of being in the Concourse Pacific Coliseum and people be like, well, blow it all up.
Yeah. I didn't even remember the score of my first game until I saw the box score today. Oh, so let's do – I want to do the NFL games too because, Bick, you're gonna love my first NFL game. And it wasn't in the 90s. It was later. I got to my first NFL game a little later. But my first game was November 14th, 2010 was my first ever NFL game. And it was in Arizona, and the 3-6 Cardinals home to the 5-4 Seattle Seahawks. So 2010.
What is this game?
This game, the Cardinals opened the scoring. It was 36-18, Seattle won. The Cardinals opened the scoring on a Tim Hightower 2-yard rush. And then Marshawn Lynch tied it up. And then Olindo Mare hit 5 field goals.
I remember that game. I'm just curious why you were at that game.
I went to Arizona with my dad, and we did a little – I think we went to a Coyotes game, and we golfed, and we went to the NFL game because they were in town. Deion Butler caught a 63-yard pass from Hasselbeck. Early Doucette scored a touchdown for the Cardinals, and then Justin Forsett in garbage time with a 4-yard rush. But what I remember about this game, the star of the game was a former Detroit Lion – and one-time high draft pick Mike Williams with 11 catches for 145 yards. He looked like I watched that game and I understood because I was like, oh, why are the Lions taking all these garbage, you know, receivers that never work out, you know, high in the draft? And I saw Mike Williams and I swear he looked like Julio Jones in this game. You couldn't guard him. He was a monster. 11 catches for 145 yards and 17 targets. From Matt Hasselbeck. That's what I remember about the 2010 game.
BMW, man. Big Mike Williams.
Yeah. That was USC Mike Williams, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. No, he was. Yeah, and he was drafted, what, second overall, I want to say? 10th overall by the Lions and then played two awful years there. And then Tennessee, Oakland did nothing. And then he came to Seattle and had... one, 65 catches for 751 yards. I probably saw the best game of Mike Williams' career that day, to be honest.
He had a better career than Charles Rogers, at least.
That is true. he did have a better career than Charles
I think
Rogers.
All of us, our first football games were Seahawks games. And the first ever game I went to was 1998 Seattle Seahawks versus the Oakland Raiders when John Gruden used to coach the Raiders back in the day. They actually, the Seahawks lost that game 31-18. And I'm just looking up right now. But Bick, it's one of those games where, believe it or not, Donald Hollis outdueled Warren Moon. And believe it or not, Walks, Amon Green played
yes.
in this game. I did not remember at all. He returned five kicks for 125 yards. He only had five carries. I have zero recollection of Amon Green as a rookie running back in that game. But there we have it. I actually watched Amon Green in his rookie season.
Sure.
Funny enough, my first game was actually a Raiders game as well. Not the same one, but...
Can you
things
imagine,
we don't
can you
remember.
Imagine if it was the same
like,
one?
You remember when Randy Moss played for the Oakland Raiders?
Yes.
Barely.
And you know,
yeah.
like,
yeah.
we've decided to just, like, cast that from our memories. I watched one of those games. It was a 60-0 Monday Nighter versus Oakland.
It's funny how, ooh, gross. It's funny how your mind works, right? Like I had said, I would have sworn that the Habs beat the Oilers 6-3 in my first ever game, but the Oilers actually won 6-3. And when I was looking for, I don't know if you guys remember your first CFL games, but when I was looking for my first CFL game, it was down to two, and I couldn't remember which came sooner. There was a game in Saskatchewan or a game in Edmonton, and so this was my memory from the game in Edmonton. I don't remember, you know, the teams necessarily, and I don't remember. Who won or anything like that, but I vividly remember Dave Sapunjis catching a ball and the announcer being like, "That's Dave Sapunjis' 500th career catch in the NFL." So I'm looking, in the CFL, and like it's a vivid memory as a kid. But then I looked up Dave Sapunjis today. He never played for the Edmonton Eskimos, and he only caught 460 catches. So I'm misremembering. Like my memory is like yesterday, and it's like that obviously never happened. Anyway, but I got it down. My first ever CFL game was 1994 in Saskatchewan against the one and done, or actually 2 years and done, but this is their final year, the Sacramento Gold Miners. And David Archer was the quarterback of Sacramento, and they came in and upset the Riders that night, 19-16.
Yeah, I remember my first ever BC Lions game. It was 1999, and it was in the summer, I believe, against the Eskimos, and I think the Lions won that game. I'm trying to find they won that game, 25-13. It was actually the season opener in 1999. I don't have the box score, but I remember Damon Allen obviously played and played fairly well for the Lions.
Yeah,
he was my guy.
It's a little tougher to find older CFL box scores.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to do that exercise. Same thing with Grizzlies. It was easy to find the box scores, but like tickets for Grizzlies and tickets for Lions were so cheap. Like I remember going to so many games as a kid. I can't actually remember what my first one was,
right.
But just trying to like go through the box score. I was just like, oh yeah, I remember this one. I remember this one. I think I went to that one. And there were so many unmemorable Grizzlies games. They all just kind of blended together as one big pounding. But I was at one of the Francis games. So that's like the one that stands out.
Yeah,
right.
I went to a lot of Grizzlies games. Like, I think I went to upwards of 50 or 60 Grizzlies
games.
They
were like $7 to get a ticket.
Dude,
they
were so
low.
And I think they had, like, student discounts and stuff, too.
Yeah.
You're right. And then you just sneak down. But I do remember the first ever Grizzlies game I went to. It was November 10, 1996, New York Knicks versus the Grizzlies. And that's why I remember it, because Patrick Ewing had 21 points and 16 rebounds. And I was just so, like, enthralled seeing Patrick Ewing play after.
I think I was at that game.
You were in 1996?
I may have been. Origin stories.
Hilarious. And Anthony Peeler was the leading scorer for the Grizzlies that game with 16 points. They lost, of course, 101-82. The Knicks were 5-1 after that game. The Grizzlies, believe it or not, were 0-6.
Weren't you on TV at a Grizzlies game? Was that not part of a story?
That was at the draft when the Grizzlies drafted Steve Francis, and James Cebulski was there talking to fans, and he interviewed me, and I was talking about how psyched I was for
really?
The Grizzlies to draft Steve Francis.
Oh man! So it would have been the score, right?
Yeah, he was with the score, yeah, and he had like a score flash on his mic and everything. And dude, so I was so hyped on the Grizzlies. Like I was like the one I was like, the team sucks, but I believe they're going to be good no matter what. And I'm like, yeah, they're going to figure it out. I'm like, believe it or not, man, they're going to get Steve Francis, they have Mike Bibby. It's going to be the new age Canadian version of Dumars and Isaiah Thomas. And I'm pretty sure that's what I said to James Cebulski.
Wow. So I didn't grow up with the Grizzlies, obviously, being in the Prairies. And so I didn't – my first NBA game actually wasn't until 2012. And then in 2013, I moved to Toronto for work. And then, yeah, I've been to, you know, I don't know, hundreds of Raptors games since then. But the first ever game – in the NBA I saw was in Phoenix. It was a different trip with buddies, but it was April 7th, 2012, and it was Steve Nash's Suns against Kobe's Lakers, except Kobe sat out that night with a sore foot. So I never did see Kobe play, unfortunately. But that night, it was a 125-105 Suns victory. Pau Gasol for the Lakers had 30 points and 13 rebounds. Andrew Bynum had 23 and 18. Really good game for him. And then over on the Suns side, it was actually Shannon Brown led the way with 24 points.
Shannon Brown. Yeah, my guy, Shannon Brown.
Michael Redd had 23, and Steve Nash had a pretty easy night. He was coming back from injury, I think, but he only played 26 minutes. He had 13 points, 11 assists as the center. Well, I was excited because it was Sebastian Telfair was in the game as well for the
Sebastian Telfair had some upside. It's just, you know, he ruined it all, but he had some upside. Yeah. You remember the hype around him coming into the draft?
Oh yeah, he was on, man, he was a star on Slam Magazine when I subscribed as a
He went straight from high school, didn't he? Like he was supposed to go to university, but he never did. He went straight from high school.
Yeah. And, yeah, there it is. Kobe Bryant did not dress, and Grant Hill did not dress for the Phoenix Suns.
Grant Hill's one of my favorite players growing up, too.
Possible for me to hear his name without thinking of Grant Hill drink Sprite.
All the Sprite commercials.
Correct. Well, yeah, I mean, NBA was – it felt like they were so far – or they were so early, I felt, for product placement and advertising. We do associate NBA players. Like, Penny Hardaway was
Little Penny,
yep. And that was Half Nike, Penny. Right? What was he advertising?
Nike.
Yeah, it was Nike. Yeah, Penny Hardaway was Nike, and Grant Hill was Sprite, right?
Yeah, Grant Hill was Sprite, and Jordan, of course, was Jordan, McDonald's and Nike, yeah. And everything else in between, and Heinz underwear, Gatorade, yeah.
Hanes.
I don't know.
Ketchup making underwear.
And didn't he also do like Fruit of the Loom too?
He did. He did both.
I think so.
Wow.
I think they may have been owned by the same company.
It is 4:23. So before we go to commercial, I do want to ask you guys the super exciting sports trivia question of the day. Are you ready?
Yes. Sure.
All right. Here it comes. Here's my question today. 14 Vancouver Canucks have had 7 or more game-winning goals in a season. And that rounds out their top 10. So 14 Canucks have had 7 game-winning goals or more in a season. Name them.
Marcus Naslund, Daniel Sedin, Pavel Bure, Tony Tanti.
That is 4. Tanti makes the list with 7, yep.
Trevor Linden?
Linden, not there.
McGillney that one year?
McGillney, not there.
Yeah, Daniel Sedin, yeah.
Yeah. Kessler?
Kessler, yep. 2010, 2011 had 7, so he's there. You got 5.
Radden Verbata?
Verbata, yep. That's 6.
What about Morrison?
Morrison, yep. Morrison got there 1 year. He had 8 in 2002-03, so that's 7 guys.
Bertuzzi
made it there once, 2002-03, had 7 game-winning goals.
Steamer?
No.
Burrow?
Did you say Burrows? Yep, Burrows is there. He also had 7. A whole schwack of guys had 7.
Sundstrom?
Patrick Sundstrom had 7 as well. Yeah, correct, that's 10. So you have 4 more. You're missing a...
Boudria? Andre Boudria?
No, you're missing a pretty obvious one.
Pretty obvious one.
Like a really obvious one? Like, well, did we say Bure?
You got Bure. But yeah, you're missing a pretty obvious one, pretty big name.
Henrik Sedin?
Henrik Sedin, yeah. Henrik Sedin had eight game-winning goals in 08-09, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, How many are we missing?
You're missing three, now, right? Three more, yeah. Three more.
Oh, Petey.
Yep. Yeah, Petey's rookie season. He had seven game-winning goals. So you're missing
Besser's rookie season?
Nope. So both guys are retired, but they are in different eras. One is
you
mentioned Naslund early, and he's the all-time record holder. He has 12 game-winning goals in 02-03. This guy had 11 game-winning goals 10 years earlier than that.
Early 90s?
Was it...
not Adams. Cornell?
Jeff Cornell, correct. And okay. and you're missing one and in that whole schwack of guys tied at seven. And he's known for having one big year with Vancouver Canucks.
Tiger Williams?
No.
No, is it Anson Carter?
It is Anson Carter.
Oh, Anson Carter.
Yeah, he had seven game-winning goals in his 33-goal season. Yeah. So there's your super happy fun time trivia question of the day. That was a fun first segment. 650-650, if you want to get in your daily isolation mailbag questions, if you want to weigh in with the first ever box score, first ever game that you went to. You can hit us up on Twitter as well. And get those shout-outs in. Coming up at 6:45 tonight, we will give some love to some of those people that deserve recognition in some pretty trying times. It is Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah, Pick the Czar. It is the program, Sportsnet 650.
Welcome to the program with Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah.
Welcome back. It is the program. Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll discuss some NFL draft eligible running backs with Matt Waldman. Andrew Walker, Satyar, Bik Nizar, we've been going through our first ever games that we went to as formative youth, I suppose, or maybe in some leagues we are a little older, and we're getting plenty of texts and tweets in as well, guys, if people are remembering their first games.
Yeah, lots of them coming in, and I'm glad people are going back in their memory bank to remember the first games they went to. Jack in Vancouver says, 10 years ago, I brought one of my best friends to his first NHL game, Canucks against Hurricanes, all the goals and fights in the first period. He got too excited and flipped the nachos all over ourselves. Not one plate, not two, not three, five. After each time he flipped them, he would run out and buy another plate. We were right by the exit at Section 310, and I apologize to the cleaning staff that had to come and clean it all up. That is Jack in Vancouver.
Rain is Lexus, text in 650-650, says, 1968, Lions versus the Stamps, a 41-7 loss, but I can't find the box score. I don't think they had box scores in 1968. It was just it was carved in the sides of caves.
That's a tough one to find. Duncan... says, my first NHL game was October 71, Bruins Canucks, won the tickets off the radio, C-Fun 14, 10 days, seats at the glass in the Canucks corner. The Canucks were up 3-0 in the first period. Bruins win 4-3, best game ever, never had those kinds of seats ever again. That is Duncan from 71.
On Twitter, this one's good. At BA Mike 7, because I said my first ever game was from 1993 in the NHL, and it was... the Oilers over the Habs 6-3, and someone by the name of Vladimir Vojtek had two goals for Edmonton. He had seven in his whole career. And Mike tweets in, he says, that's a name I haven't heard in a minute. Vojtek was my cousin's teammate in Tri-City. I remember watching him play in the Dub 30 years ago. So there you go, a little throwback. Andrew Walker and
Mike's
Satyar
a good guy,
Shah.
Yeah.
So I've never been to a soccer game other than MLS before. I've never been to an EPL game, but you guys probably have.
No, I have been. I'm trying to find exactly what year it was. I was trying to ask my mom earlier. What year was it going to England again? Was it 92 or was it 91? I can't remember which year it was, but it was one of those years when I went and watched a Chelsea game. I know Bick remembers it fondly. You remember?
I've only ever been to one. I don't know if I should say.
You should.
All right. Well, it was May 8th, 2011, really late in the season. Only two teams had a chance to win the title, Manchester United and Chelsea. And really, this was like the battle of the juggernauts. Whoever won it is going to win the title. And it was a record-breaking 19th title for Manchester United, defeating some team called Chelsea.
Out of here.
We're just like, they're okay.
You're just making it up.
And, no, it's not making it up. They won 2-1. You know, Chicharito scored minute in. Vidic scored later. It was great.
Yeah, I remember I was in England. I think it was 91 or 92 and watched Chelsea-Tottenham play. Chelsea won that match 2-0. But
against Tottenham? Go figure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who doesn't beat Tottenham? But, yeah.
Oh, yeah. If I had a nickel. What? You guys can keep talking. That's all right.
No, I'm just saying. That's as far as I remember for those ones. I mean, I remember watching like the Whitecaps before they went to the MLS. I mean, I remember going to Swangard numerous times through the years to watch them play.
Yeah, and I've actually never been to an NCAA football game either, believe it or not.
Yeah, neither have I.
Interesting. Maybe that's when sports comes back. When sports are a thing again, that'll be something we can do. 650-650 if you want to weigh in this conversation or get in your shout-outs for later in the show. Matt Walden coming up in a few seconds. Justin Bourne is going to join us after 5. And, I mean, you know what's funny? We talked about right off the top of you know, sitting here in isolation and trying to stay in and certain things, including, you know, working out is... You gotta try to do it. You can go for runs, but you know your gym is generally closed, and we don't all have, you know, home gyms and things of that nature. Well, all these professional athletes that are currently in a very similar situation to us. Yes, some of them have, you know, beautiful homes and acreages and all that kind of stuff. But Bourne in his article today touched on how if the NHL just comes back suddenly in a few months. It's not like everyone's going to be in bad shape, but there is going to be a wide array of different levels of conditioning, right? Like if you're a young guy in a new city and you're in a, you know, even here in Vancouver and you're in a downtown condo and you're not special, your gym, your public access is closed just like anybody else. So how dedicated are you? How creative are you? We're gonna find out in a few months if indeed they do try to finish this season out in either the NBA or the NHL. NFL draft, it's the only thing on the calendar that's really coming still and giving us a sense of normalcy. Let's check in on some of the running backs from this class with Matt Waldman. You can check out Matt at mattwaldmanrsp.com and the rookie scouting portfolio. It's available now. He joins us on Sportsnet 650. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing well. Long time no here. You guys doing all right?
Yeah, we're doing okay. All things considered, we always kind of open with you know the sense of the NFL draft. It's like the only thing on our calendar that we pretty much know is going to go, and it gives us kind of a sense of something to look forward to. Do you find it's you're pouring yourself even more into your work these days? How do you approach it?
It's the same, to be honest with you. I mean, it's. It's always, you know, when you put out a publication that's almost 1,200 pages in length and you're writing 500 of those in a month, you've been socially distancing for every you know, March through April for 16 years now. So it's, you know, the strange thing has been leaving the house to go grocery shopping when I've needed to or to do when you leave the office and look at what's going on in the world. So to be honest, I'm just getting a chance to get a sense of the abnormal lifestyle that we've been going through right now as a continent, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Running backs are always a tricky conversation because it's that position right now that more and more you wonder, hey, like, you know, should you use a first round pick on a running back anywhere? How many guys to you, Matt, are certainly in the conversation to go at some juncture in the first round?
I mean, I think that depending on the fit with the team, that's always really the big important. That's the important matter. But let's expand it to the first two rounds, because I think when you have players in the first two rounds or even the first two and a half rounds, you're talking about top quality athletes. So if we're going to look for the first two and a half rounds of the draft, there's probably about six to eight players that could go in the first 2.5 rounds, and the likelihood of that happening is probably low. So I would say there's probably about 3 to 5 that will go in the first 2.5 rounds, and then there'll be the remaining guys that I mentioned there, the remaining 3 to 4 will probably end up being available in early round 4.
We're talking to Matt Waldman, and you can always check out Waldman's work at mattwaldmanrsp.com, the rookie scouting portfolio available now. And it's always a must-read for big-time draft fans. And one of the things I love about your breakdown is the running backs in general. And I know this is like one of your top areas of expertise. You do great work with all the offensive players. But I've had a really interesting time looking at these running backs in this year's group. And you're right, there's like 3 to 5 guys that will go in that range. And to me, it's really hard to differentiate a lot of these guys. Like, I think Clyde Edwards-Helaire is super interesting to me. Like, what do you think of him, and how big of a gap do you think there is between the top running back on your board and the number 5 guy?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Clyde Edwards-Helaire is probably in the second tier for me, but that second tier this year are guys that I've graded out as, if you put them into a lineup right now, they can produce, and depending on the offense, they could produce as starters in the league. You know, Helaire is a terrific back in terms of vision. He understands his running schemes. He understands how to set up his blocks very well. He's skilled at identifying not only defenders on the periphery that he needs to avoid who are shooting into the backfield, but also being able to formulate solutions with his footwork. The eyes and the feet of the running back have to be in sync. It's kind of a lot like, think of a guitarist who has a lot of good licks in his vocabulary. And, you know, how well that they're able to play and improvise a solo, it's kind of the same way with a running back with his eyes and his footwork, how well he can process information and then translate that with, you know, refined footwork to be able to avoid pursuit or penetration and then be able to get downhill efficiently to be able to gain yardage. And he's very good at that. He's an excellent route runner as a receiver. He's a little short-armed, and he has some issues at times being able to catch the football in tight coverage where he, you know, tighter coverage, you know, with him can be a bit of an issue. He doesn't have great long speed, so he's kind of a guy who's aspiring to be like Devonta Freeman when Devonta Freeman was in his prime. He's a tough runner, a smart runner, needs to work on his pass protection, needs to work on being able to catch the ball in tight coverage, and if he can develop in his pass pro, in his tight coverage, you know, as a receiver, he has a nice future as at least a lead back in a committee early on. I think he can work out as a guy who is probably a little bit more of a James White type of back, you know, in terms of what he can offer a team at least this year. And the difference between him and the first, you know, guys, I mean, again, it's the difference between a guy who can come in right now, start and probably carry the ball, touch the ball 15 to 20 times a game, whereas I think Edwards-Helaire is more of a guy that can give you, you know, 8 to 12 touches per game and feel pretty good about what he can deliver for you right now.
So who is your RB1 for this year's group? Is it J.K. Dobbins, DeAndre Swift, Jonathan Taylor, or somebody else?
Yeah, it's J.K. Dobbins, and the difference between him and Jonathan Taylor is pretty small in terms of just the overall grade. Jonathan Taylor is the best pure runner in this class. But if we're going to grade running backs based on the position and all the requirements of the position, J.K. Dobbins is over him. And really, J.K. Dobbins isn't far away as a runner either. He's just, you know, he's a player who has a great short area quickness. He has a low center of gravity. He's someone that understands his blocking schemes. He'll take a few chances that maybe he shouldn't, but he understands what he's reading, how he should process it. He has a very strong skill to be able to get into the open field and break away from defensive backs, but he also has the balance, power, and footwork to operate between the tackles and heavy traffic. I think he has some of the best feet that I've seen from a running back in terms of being able to work through traffic that I've seen in a while. He reminds me a little bit of LaDainian Tomlinson with his footwork, but in terms of his overall build, in terms of what he can do, you know, overall as a runner for you, as a receiver, in addition to that, he reminds me a little bit of Ray Rice and a faster version of what Ray Rice offered when he was a Pro Bowl caliber player with the Ravens.
Matt Waldman joins us here on the program, Sportsnet 650. Check out his work, mattwaldmanrsp.com, the rookie scouting portfolio. It's interesting because when you look at, I don't know, the top, give or take, six, seven, eight guys at the position, they're all 5'8", 5'9", 5'7", 5'10". And like, is that just one of those things? Is it just one of those years? Because we don't really see the... you know, less and less the Eddie Georges or the Derrick Henrys or, you know, AP, Todd Gurley, these are bigger guys. This year's class all is a little smaller.
Yeah, much of the class is smaller. And the sweet spot for running back has always been kind of that 5'8 to 5'11 range, somewhere between about 210 to 220 pounds. So a lot of these guys just fit into that sweet spot of what you're looking for in a back. Now, A.J. Dillon is a good exception. He's 6 feet, 247 pounds, and he's a Derrick Henry type, and I personally think that he belongs in the conversation with the rest of these backs as someone that deserves, you know, a lot of love. And he's, you know, he's a nimble big back who's really stayed healthy with 866 carries, which is kind of a throwback because a lot of these backs in the past who did that, the Adrian Petersons, the LaDainian Tomlinsons, Ricky Williams, even Cedric Benson, going further back. There's a lot of guys who've had that kind of workload, but it hasn't been since like the early to mid-90s that we've really seen that on a consistent basis. But Dillon stayed healthy with 866 rushing attempts, and when you do that, that's an asset. That's not something you should be worried about the way a lot of people say, well, there's not enough tread left on the tire. Well, if the guy hasn't been injured, hasn't had chronic issues, nothing shows up on his medical report, you should look at that as a strength because he's going to do that in the NFL.
And when you're looking at sort of these running backs in this year's group, and you kind of mentioned there's going to be like three to five guys that go in the first 2 days, does it make sense to kind of wait on those running backs and get value like you kind of mentioned a bit later in this draft?
I think it does if you're depending on what your offense is about. I mean, it really comes down to who your offense is. We love to, you know, all of us in the media and all of us who do this and with analysis love to try and apply a broad brush to what is the right thing to do in general. And there's, we're talking about more than, you know, two dozen different teams that are out there with varying systems and varying situations with their personnel where it may make sense for a team to draft first round with that back. Because I know that we get all the analytics and they like to try and apply the analytics to it and say, well, this with a broad brush. Well, you know, I mean, that's fine, but it's kind of like Marie Kondo trying to tell a researcher to minimize their office space and that they shouldn't have so many books. You know, that person's just going to laugh at her. You know, so it's to me, the situation applies with this is that if you have a passing down offense, that you're a heavy passing offense where you're going to be able to get by with a back who can do a certain number of things for you. And those guys on your board, you have 5 to 6 of those guys available on your board who pass muster. Yeah, you wait. But if you're looking to be a run first offense, maybe you're going to run a lot of gap. You're going to run, you know, you're going to have play action off of it and you have a good offensive line. And if you get a great back behind a good offensive line, maybe you do want to draft a Jonathan Taylor in the first round because you know he and maybe one other guy or two other guys are at best are the best fit for what your team does, and you don't want to risk losing one of them.
Well, the talk in NFL draft and running backs, it sparks joy with us. So
yes.
So thanks for doing this, Matt. Have a great rest of your evening.
Hey, you too, guys, and stay safe.
All right, Matt Waldman. Catch his work, mattwaldmanrsp.com. That is the rookie scouting portfolio. Love the Kondo references.
Yeah, great, great. Have you ever watched that? Have you watched Marie Kondo's methods? Have you learned?
Absolutely.
Have you been enlightened?
Absolutely not. I mean, I'm aware. It's like you pick up this is my understanding of it because I haven't actually watched. You don't want to clutter your life, so you pick up something. Like right now, I have a water bottle. Does this spark joy? And if no, you throw it away. Which
I don't get part of it. That's only to identify the things you want to keep and don't want to keep.
Yeah, but
the thing that's important about watching is the folding method and learning how to compartmentalize your space and have more space. So don't get so caught up in what sparks joy or not and taking that and having fun with it or whatever. Think about the methods you learn to keep your life cleaner and tidier. That's the important lesson here, not what sparks joy or not. That's only a way to disseminate what to keep and what not to keep.
Yeah, okay, but I am holding this water bottle. It does not spark joy. But I'm not going to throw it away. I need the water bottle.
Well,
I drink water out of it.
It's more about sparking joy thing is more about clothes than it is like, you know, necessary items. Like, yeah, we all need cups and cutlery. It doesn't spark joy, but it's a necessity.
Like when I come
it's more about that sweater you have that you always wear that you probably shouldn't wear anymore. And if it's like, does it spark joy? Yes, then keep it. If it doesn't and it's old, get rid of it. It's raggy.
Those F-boy pants, do those spark joy?
They do. That's why
they
I wear
don't,
them. Even
they
I
don't spark
them.
Joy
spark
for
ridicule.
Anybody. When I come into work and see you hooligans, I don't like, you don't spark joy. But maybe that's why we're in quarantine for 3 months. Maybe you'll spark a little more joy when we return to work eventually.
Well, you know why you don't get a text back? Because you don't spark joy.
You're actually not wrong. Marie Kondo screwing over my dating life because everyone goes by her methods and everyone's like, nah, throw them away. Throw them away.
Hoisted by your own petard.
Yeah, story of my life. Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah, and Bick Nizar. When we come back, we're going to talk to Justin Bourne. This is going to be a lot of a pot calling the kettle black as we criticize NHLers for not being in shape when we come back. Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the program with Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah.
I can't keep on losing you. 5:02 on your Thursday, Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah, home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. The Subway text line is open, 650-650. If you want to weigh in on, well, a few things that we're doing today. Number one, we're kind of recounting your earliest memories, like the first game that you ever went to in any of the various big sports. If you can find box score, do a little digging on online. It's pretty fun, some of the details that maybe you forgot about your first games. Also, the Daily Isolation Mailbag coming up in the 6 o'clock hour. Ask us anything. 650-650, sports, non-sports, whatever it is. We'll get to those. And as well, your daily shout-outs for frontline healthcare workers or people that are doing a lot of good these days. If you want somebody to shout-out somebody and get some love, by all means, give us a text. 650-650. We'll get to that right before the city of Vancouver begins their daily cheer tradition at 7 p.m. Justin Bourne is coming up in a few minutes from Hockey Central at noon and Sportsnet. Want to touch on him with a bunch of stuff. We'll have some fun, but one of the things in his new piece up on sportsnet.ca, Sat, it looks in, I mean, you think that we have difficulty, whether it's motivation or just facilities, to get in shape or stay in shape. Well, professional athletes right now are no different. Everybody's in isolation. And even if you are a millionaire hockey player, it doesn't necessarily mean you have all the access to, you know, any more state-of-the-art training equipment than, say, you and I do.
No, and they're going to have to get creative, too. I mean, how many players are watching, like, online classes and doing all these, like, you know, like, high-energy yoga things and whatever? I mean, that's what you're resorted to. Like, unless you live in a home that has everything and has a big yard, you can get out and run in and do different things, like, you are kind of screwed. And I do wonder that as time goes on, if there will be something done where certain facilities will be made available to certain people and what teams can come up with, because I don't care how creative you get, you can't maintain a professional level of athleticism and conditioning just doing workouts in your own living room. Like, there's a certain ceiling you hit at some point.
Right. Yes. You and I can, you know, lift a chair over our heads and go for a run, and like we can kind of maintain our level of fitness, if you will, but not these guys. Like these guys are these guys have to be in next level shape. And you see some guys like, listen, Alexander Ovechkin has a whole, you know, a massive gym to himself, right? We've seen them on Instagram. But not everyone's like that. Like, I'll just throw out a name here, like, because we've seen kind of viz of them on social media. Tyler Toffoli and his wife are in Vancouver in a downtown condo, and they've posted some viz of them at 7 p.m., right? Like, the gym in Tyler Toffoli's condo is closed, like everybody else's, right? So what does a guy like that, what does a guy like that do, for instance?
Yeah, and I mean, how, like, can you, like, bench press your significant other, your spouse? Like, can you do something like that? Like, do you come up with, like, creative tandem workouts where you use somebody else's leverage?
Yeah, I know. Justin Bourne touched on some of this in his latest article, Sportsnet.ca. He joins us now on Sportsnet 650. How's it going?
Good, guys. How's it going today?
Okay, you know, we're just like the NHLers. It's just like, we'd love to get in shape and stay in shape, but hey, everything's closed. But it is funny, though. Like, you know, you and I can go out for a run, and that's pretty good. But that's not good enough if you are going to be back playing on NHL ice in maybe a playoff scenario in 2.5 months.
Yeah, we had Spezza on Hockey Central on Wednesday, and it was really funny because I asked him, I was like, you know, what are you doing, you know, given the circumstances and no one has gyms and it's all closed and blah, yada, yada. I tried to set it up, like, what are you doing? And you could, like, hear him trying not to say, like, you know, I'm rich, right? Like, he was, like, so tactful about being like, well, I've got a pretty good facility, situation at my home. I'm here with my four daughters, and I'm doing the math. I'm like, yeah, like 15 years in the NHL, perennial all-star, has four kids. He probably has a massive house. He probably owns Planet Fitness. So he's a little bit different than you and I. But, yeah, there are some guys here in Toronto and there in Vancouver who live in apartments who I'm sure are struggling to do anything besides cardio. It's tough to do productive strength training when you don't have any facilities.
Yeah, exactly. And this gets into the question, too, like, we had this discussion when the lockout happened in the 05 one. It's one of the more amazing athletic stories, I think, of all time in the NHL. Teemu Selänne looked done. His career looked finished. And, you know, he was in Colorado for that last year, and whatever, he had like 13 goals. It looked like he was going to fizzle out. And then he had over a year off to rest, recover, train, rehab, all that kind of stuff. And then he came back and he was a superstar for another 10 years. Like, no one saw that coming. And I do wonder with this break, you know, there's going to be some players that never get back to speed in the NHL, but there's going to be some guys that maybe get a little bit of a career boost from this as well.
Yeah, man. And actually, that's, you know, not to keep going back to that Spezza interview, but that's something that he had said too, was that he remembers the 2012-13 lockout season. And he said that some guys, particularly older guys, came back and were a step behind and never got it back. And he said he was working out with, like, the fear of that happening to him, which is very real. But you're 100% right that it's almost interesting to think about the career span of some of the great players and the value it might have for a guy to say, I'm going to sit this one out. And we, you know, take a whole year off somewhere in the middle of a career. You know, we see Kawhi doing load management and in the NBA, and I understand that's different, but you're right. This is going to go a long way for certain guys. And you know, I don't know how it is there in Vancouver, exactly what the injury situation is, but there are some guys, and I'm thinking of Morgan Rielly specifically for the Maple Leafs, who this will go a long way for. It's going to be interesting to see who it helps.
I think it will help guys like that who are young that just need a little bit of rest. But the thing that I keep wondering too is, it's one thing if you're a bit older and you need the break, but at the same time, you still need to be working on your game. And as far as your conditioning, working on your flexibility, recovering from injuries, meeting a physiotherapist every day. So as much as in theory, that whole notion of, you know, not playing, you get healthy, and you get back. And that's true for guys like Rielly that can get back into gear really quickly, or at least relatively quickly. I just kind of wonder about those guys who are a bit older that aren't using this time to literally make their bodies better outside of just resting.
Yeah, it is interesting to know. Like, I think one of the things that I kind of theorized in what I wrote today for Sportsnet just really quickly was that I think we're going to see a wide range of outcomes. Like, I don't think the game's going to come back and we're going to be like, oh, everyone looks slow or, oh, everyone looks amazing. I think some guys are going to stand out as they just didn't have good situations and weren't able to train and it didn't work out for them. Whereas I imagine if you're a guy like Spezza who has some money and you're later in your career, imagine if you didn't have kids and that was your situation and you lived in one place with a good home gym. Like, man, you'd come out of that like rocky. So I think we're going to see a wide range of outcomes after this.
He is Justin Bourne, Sportsnet, Sportsnet.ca and Hockey Central at noon on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. One thing we were looking at, you probably saw the tweet earlier. Do you remember offhand or any details about the first ever NHL game you attended as a kid?
Can I say like the most like my dad played in the NHL story you've ever heard? this is like the type of thing I try not to say because people, it just looks bad on me in my career. But the first game I really remember going to was like 90 or 91. My dad retired from the Kings in 88. So it was like a year or two, 3 years after he retired. And, you know, of course, I would have gone to games much younger when he was with the Islanders and when he played, but this is one I really remember. So we got to go. It was in Vancouver. I was living in Kelowna. So we drove to the game. And before the game, we got to go down to the Kings dressing room. And Luc Robitaille, my dad brought me around. I was like, yeah, these are all the guys I know. I played for the team a couple years ago. And Luc Robitaille let me tape his stick for the game. And Luc Robitaille scored a hat trick.
Oh,
in that game.
Wow.
I know. I actually need to go back and look at, like, Robitaille hat-trick in Vancouver, because maybe this is not even a true story at all. This is exactly how it played out in my 11-year-old memory. And after the game, we got an autograph Wayne Gretzky sticks. It was one of the greatest days of my life, so maybe I shouldn't have told that story. It feels like a very entitled kid story, but that's what happened. So
no, it's an amazing story. It makes my Vladimir Vojtech 2 goals against Andre Rasico story. I didn't tape his stick. But it is funny because it would not surprise me. I'm not doubting your story. But it's amazing how your memory works as a kid, and it could have been, like, if we Google that game.
I'm going to look this up when we get off.
Well, yeah. Luc Robitaille might have had a second assist, but you watched him score in warm-up, and you were like, you know, like that. That's how sometimes you can misremember. Although
I'm going to be crushed, enough. By the way, if Robitaille doesn't have a hat trick in Vancouver, like somewhere over that span, I'm going to be absolutely devastated.
We'll find it. What year was it? Early.
It was sometime I want to say between 89 and 91, somewhere after my dad's career.
Oh, and your dad had retired. Already.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I understand. Yeah.
We'll get on the Google machine and look that up.
Well, on the topic of, you know, how memory can deceive you, Walks and I were talking about this a bit earlier. When you're younger, there are certain players that you grew up watching that you're like, man, this player was amazing. Then as you get older, you go back and watch some games and you go back and look at the stat sheet and you're like, well, maybe this guy wasn't as good as I thought he was. Was there a player when you were younger you thought was amazing, but as you got older, you realized you may have misjudged the greatness of an individual?
That's a good question. I can see, you know, like some of the guys my dad played with that I was just huge fans of them as people. So maybe I was a little bit biased in that direction. But now that I think about it, like my favorite player when my dad played was Bernie Nichols. And then I got older and I was like, oh, Bernie Nichols is actually amazing. Like I'm kind of the opposite where I've discovered that like this kind of guy who'd just been like having beers in my backyard is actually a pretty legendary player. So that's kind of the reverse effect in my weird situation here.
Because I always find that kind of funny, too, because, like, there are certain, like, I find this with different sports, too, and hockey, where I'm, like, when I'm small and when I'm younger, I'm thinking of how good this player was, and I'm like, man, this guy was amazing. And, like, one guy I always thought was really good was Murray Barron. Like, he was physical, he was stay-at-home defenseman for the Canucks, like, he was heart and soul, right? And then I went back and watched some games from the West Coast Express era just recently, and I'm like, he can't even move. Like, why did I think this guy was any good? But I thought he was, like, one of the heart and soul players on the team, a stay-at-home defenseman. He punished guys. He was actually really, really good. And when I go back and watch, and I'm like, no, he actually wasn't any good. And the reason I liked him was because he was physical.
Well, that's, I think, the trend you would find there is physical players in general of that era, where you would absolutely love to watch, you know, you can go through the list of tough guys and then realize that they were pretty one-dimensional and, like, you know, all the love was maybe a little bit misplaced considering how we see the NHL today.
I got bad news for you.
No hat trick?
Luke Robitaille never had a hat trick in Vancouver, so it might have been two goals and an assist or something like that.
I'm going game log when we get off here.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, you have
there
to
was
go
a game
log.
In L.A. where Robitaille had a hat trick against the Canucks.
Yes, Robitaille did have a hat trick against the Canucks in L.A., but this game was in Vancouver.
God, maybe. But you know, right now I could, like, hear my brain being like, did we go to L.A.? Was it in L.A.? It was definitely not in L.A., so I got to figure this out.
Yeah,
was it a preseason game, maybe?
Was it a hockey game at all? Was it? I think it was a Grizzlies game. I was at a Vancouver Grizzlies game.
Well, and I was telling the story, like, when I was a kid, talking about misremembering, I was trying to think of memories from my first CFL game, and I don't know if it was my first, but I went to a game in Edmonton, and we were sitting really low. I remember that, and I remember a receiver. This is how my mind worked. A receiver for the Eskimos by the name of Dave Sapunjis caught a catch, and then the announcer's like, "That was Dave Sapunjis's 500th CFL catch," and everybody applauded. So I'm looking for this box score. And I look up Dave Sapunjis. He never played for the Eskimos, and he only caught 460 catches. So, like, I don't know what my mind is doing. It must have been someone totally different. But, yeah, when you're, I don't know, you're 7, 8, 9 years old, you misremember everything. Who is your
– that's a lesson. That's a lesson for kids. That's for young players. That's a lesson, like, for how to treat the young fans and the 8-year-old at the game. And, like, it's so much bigger to them than the players even realize. So that's something you can use as a teaching tool, I think.
Yeah, totally. And it's another thing, like, I'll be honest, I have a bit of a conflicted relationship with all the retro games being played right now. And it's great, whatever. Mm-hmm. We got to do something. I get that.
Right.
But when you watch something for the first time live and you live and die with the up and down emotion of a game and you have certain memories of it, if you watch as a, for me anyway, like a jaded, cynical media adult now, and I'm watching like the 1992 Blue Jays or, you know, way back in the day, like, it kind of jolts you into reality a little bit. Like, I don't always like watching certain moments because I'd rather keep the romantic notion in my head of how I felt watching it years ago.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I will say, specifically to those, like, 92, 93 Blue Jays World Series, like, even watching some of, like, the batting stances and stuff is like, oh, like, what? It's like, why does it look so, I don't know, just unprofessional compared to how, you know, everyone's so out of a mold now, how you're supposed to look. So you're right. There is something to enjoying the sport with the rose-colored lenses on your memory.
I will say, though, that watching old baseball games, I think baseball holds up the best.
I'd agree with that.
In the sense of they're still hitting the ball 400 feet, they're still throwing, maybe not as hard as they did today, but guys are still, you know, throwing curveballs and making good plays. Like it feels like it still feels like baseball to me. Where, man, you watch even hockey from, I think the cutoff is basically 2004, you know, with the lockout. But you watch even that Tampa Bay Calgary Stanley Cup final, you're like, what is this?
Really? Yeah, it's, you know, we're so robbed of information too, because video was so bad so recently. Like even that series you just mentioned, like, I know you can find it, but the quality of video is so much worse. And if you want to watch a game from the 90s, God, it's like watching an 8-pixel Nintendo game or something. It's just like, I don't know how bad the, how quickly the technology has changed here, but it sure seems like it was very different not that long ago. So it's tough to even get a sense for what those games looked like in real time. It doesn't look right, does it? It's been a massive shift in hockey.
Well, when the quality is completely different, but as far as like the romanticized thing too, I think one of the things that I want to get back to is having less video review in all sports, really. I mean, as much as I like the idea of, you know, egregious offsides. I like the idea of, you know, of course, you know, goalie interference. But at this point, like, I'd rather just go back to, did the puck cross the line or not? Because I find now with the stoppages and play. Like, as soon as a goal gets scored, you're like, was it offside or not? Like, should we celebrate this goal? Or should we be like, well, let's see the play on the blue line first? Like, as much as technology has helped the game, I do think at some point it takes away the enjoyment of the game too.
Well, and no sport is worse than football, where, like, every conceivable deep ball, you're like, all right, a thing happened. Did it really happen? Like, there's like a 10% chance the play you just watched happened. Like, it's so frustrating in football. And I get it in hockey, too. It would be really hard to go from getting it right and the people who are on the right side of the calls being rewarded to being like, that was mildly inconvenient for me as a fan. So who cares who, you know, like, it would be really hard for me to go back. I totally agree that it hampers with the flow of the game and isn't ideal, but I personally wouldn't want to go back to saying, let's just try to get it as close to possible. I kind of want it right now.
We do a daily mailbag in the 6 o'clock hour. People kind of send in their questions. Some are sports, some are just more random than you'd believe. And the one question yesterday was if you could change any rule in the NHL, be it, you know, like a minor tweak or a major shift change, what would that be?
Well, you know, when I coached there with Sheldon Keefe, I kept a notebook because he said the most outlandish things that he was dead serious about that he would change in the NHL. One of them was no face-offs, like just none, no face-offs at all. You know, like I actually don't hate the idea of when you play beer league hockey and your team scores, the team pulls it out of their net and just fires it down the ice and says, start up again, go from there. I enjoy that. I like the concept of keeping the flow going. My more practical thing they could change is I really do think puck over the glass is, like, it's kind of a stupid subjective thing that is immensely penal for a team, particularly on the penalty kill that fires one over. I would like there to be some subjectivity for the ref to say, I think he meant to do that. I think he didn't mean to do that. I know that makes fans upset, but it just seems like it's such a stupid penalty to me because the guy's not trying to do it. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm kind of tired of the hand pass in general. Like, if you're not going to have the hand pass in the offensive zone, don't have it at all. Like, you can pass the puck with your hand. And the other one is, unless you lift your skate to kick a puck in, I'm fine with kicking motion as long as your blade's on the ice.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what? The hand pass thing's a really great point. Like, we're trying to increase offense in the game. Why is the defensive team allowed to sweep the puck with his hand to his teammate? Like, it's completely, you know, it goes against everything the league says that it's trying to do. I'm with you. That one, they should be stricken too. And the kicking one, I think I'm okay with. I think I can be talked into that one. It's another one where, are we going to get into the how many microns of a whatever is it? Like, is your skate blade off the ice, on the ice? You know, so it just brings up another sort of technical issue. I agree with it in theory, though, for sure.
And I wanted to do something a little more drastic. I'm getting sick of the forward pass. I don't know, but what about you?
Straight up rugby back passing. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Take us back to Joe Malone, Phantom Joe, or whatever. I don't even know when they made that change.
You could have said any name. Oh, Bugsy Scraggs. I remember him in the 40s.
Well, yeah. That's what I always bug Merrick about. It's because he's just full of that. He's like, well, it's like Cyclone Taylor. You're like, okay, relax. You're like 40.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, half the time on the show, I'm like, do you want me to call you out on that? And he's like, well, you know, one of the best of all times at blocking shots on the penalty kill was Flibble Mabble Needs from, like, you know, whatever. And you're like, was it? Like, does anyone know that?
Yeah. No. You not only were you not alive, but, like, there's not even footage from when he was alive. So stop pretending. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe that he knows. It's tough to call him out when I don't.
Hey, always good catching up, man. Have a great evening.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right, Justin Bourne, his latest is up right now on sportsnet.ca. That is a terrific Luke Robitaille story. And I bet he had like two goals and an assist or something. But yeah, he never, Luke Robitaille never had a hat trick in Vancouver. Certainly not with the LA Kings. So we'll have to find that actual box score.
Yeah, I think Bick found a few. So Bick sent this to us in our chat. Robitaille had four games in Vancouver where he scored two goals, one game where he had 4 points.
That might be it. And what year was that?
I don't know the year exactly. I just know that that's one of the four games.
Because it would have been, doing my math here, so Bob Bourne's last season is 88 with the Kings. So it would have been probably, yeah, between 89 and 92, somewhere in there. Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah Biknazar and Justin Morissette along as well. It is 525, so we'll go to break. 650-650 is the Subway text line. And by the way, if you're looking for updates on everything related to COVID-19, of course, News 1130, number one for breaking news, traffic, and weather in Vancouver. Tune in to get the latest updates on the coronavirus, or you can visit them, news1130.com. They're doing a great job of keeping us all informed. When we come back, we're going to talk a little Seahawks. Joe Fan for NBC Sports Northwest is a Seahawks insider. How is their offseason looking? How do they compete in what could be the toughest division in football, and what are their plans in the draft? Is it another trade back year for the Seattle Seahawks? That's coming up next. Sportsnet 650.
This is the program with Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah.
.533 on your Thursday. TGIF. No, wait. TGIT. Tomorrow's TGIF.
TGIT.
Can't wait for the weekend, Sat.
Can't wait to get home on the weekend. And by home, I mean get from one room to another.
It's the only thing, not the only thing, but in this whole non-ideal scenario, the one thing I've been thinking of, this is a very glass-half-empty kind of thing. But, like, we only get so many Fridays in our lifetimes, right? Fridays is, like, who doesn't like a Friday if you're the classic Monday to Friday kind of person? And the weekend's here, and, like, we're going to waste a bunch of Fridays where it's, like, you have nothing to look forward to. I hate losing Fridays. Friday's my favorite day of the week, and now it's just another day.
You know, how else do we blow off steam? Like, you're constantly, like, we don't even generate steam. We're just, like, idle. You got to keep moving to generate steam to start blowing it off, you know what I mean? And right now it's kind of like, you know.
Yeah, and part of me, like, really wants it to be nice and sunny out and, you know, kind of get, I could get the patio kind of going and set up and easier to get out for walks and runs. But if the weather's not that great at all, it means that people are more inclined to do the right thing and stay in and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you know what? We can gripe and complain all we want. We just got to grin and bear it, I guess. I did last night I did cave a little bit. So on I have all the streaming services, which we all do now, and I am getting a little sick of it. It takes me forever to find the right movie or the right show and all that. I'm probably going to start Barry tonight, your recommendation.
Oh, it's good. You'll enjoy Barry.
Yeah. Last night on the just the on-demand portion of your TV, which you can rent the movies, they've started because all movie theaters are closed. So the movies that are in the theaters, you can kind of now rent on demand, except they're like $20. Right. And I caved last night, so I wanted to watch that The Hunt movie. Where
did you watch it?
Yeah, I paid $20 to rent it.
Oof.
I know. Oof is right.
By the reviews, I don't think that was a good choice.
No, it wasn't. There was a couple interesting little moments, but it was not. It was just a bad decision. That's like 2 months of Netflix that I just ordered with one click of the button.
Isn't that the new age version of Surviving the Game, the Ice-T movie? Like that?
It's same basic principle. Hunting humans for sport and rich people. Yeah. With a modern twist, basically.
With a modern twist, yeah, I suppose. So, and that's why, like, I am intrigued to watch it. I don't know if I can fork over $20 for it, though.
Yeah,
I mean, saying the guy,
and I did because I'm very wealthy.
Wealthy.
It was stupid. It was a waste of $20. I could have gotten Uber Eats tonight or something, which I probably still would.
Man, I spent $5 was it last week on watching The Martian because I couldn't find it on any streaming service. So I watched about 2/3 of it, and then I shut it off because I had something else to do. I mean, yeah, because I'm so busy, I had to do something else. And then I forgot to watch the rest of it, and the movie expired in 48 hours. So I spent $5 to watch a movie I've seen like 10 times, and I didn't even watch the whole thing.
Hey, Bick, what's worse? I spent $20 to watch a new release, or sat spending $5 to watch an old movie and then not finishing it?
Definitely Sats.
Yeah, right?
Yes. That's not even really close. Like, so, at least he watched the entire product.
I've seen, and I love that movie. And I kind of forgot I had downloaded. I mean, I had rented it, and then I went to watch it the other day, and it expired. And I thought about paying another $5, but I'm like, I can't.
By the way, Wax, I have this secret to you, because I also, you know, struggle to find things to watch in the moment on Netflix. You got to take like 40 minutes and go through all the categories and add everything to your list. So then down the road, you make up the time difference later.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, add to the list.
It's long and it's boring, but like it helps down the road.
You think I'm a dork? Bick is already Excel sheeting what to watch on Netflix.
Facts.
Although, you know what? So The Martian, you know where The Martian lost me, though?
Where?
So all those scenes, the external scenes, they were filmed in Wadi Rum, which is it's in Jordan. It's not even Mars.
What? That's good. That's good.
Well played. You got us again today.
is that going to be part of your stand-up routine?
You know what? It should be. That goes in my 5 minutes on my bucket list. We all come out of this nonsense. With that, we go to – right now, Joe Fan's on the line. He's like, can I hang up, please? Joe Fan joins us, NBC Sports Northwest Seahawks insider. How you doing, Joe?
I'm good. I feel cheated. I want the rest of the 5 minutes.
It's not that good, and some of it's pretty dirty. And I got only like 3.5 minutes right now. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'll see if I can
to the YouTube link later.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find a joke I'm working on that is air appropriate. How are you doing? How are things in your state? It's you know, you're not far from us, and sometimes it feels like a world apart right now.
Yeah, it's okay. Honestly, I feel like, you know, we're starting to see a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. Granted, it's still got a ways to go, but I feel like we're seeing the benefits of social distancing, which is positive because it, you know, tells everyone how important it is and how valuable it's been to slowing things down in Seattle, in the greater Seattle area. So kudos to Jay Inslee for acting quickly, and, you know, kudos to everyone for kind of coming together. I think it's a proud time to be from the Pacific Northwest, where I think, you know, for the most part, everyone gets it and, you know, is going through it together, but also getting through it together.
So we talk about the NFL season having that sense of normalcy because free agency is there and there's trades and the draft is coming up. How have you graded the Seahawks offseason compared to recent years?
Well, it still has to be incomplete. You know, you can't give them an F until it's done. You can't give them an A assuming what might happen. You know what I mean? So, we're still kind of waiting for what that big pass rushing name is. And obviously we all know about Jadeveon Clowney, and we're waiting to see what he ends up doing and what ends up happening with Everson Griffin. And, you know, what happens with Marcus Golden? What happens, you know, does Yannick Ngakoue finally get traded? What happens to Matt Judon? Does he get traded or does he play in Baltimore? And so, you know, as it stands right now, knowing, you know, you went in and your biggest need is still left unfilled. It has to be incomplete, but you also can't panic yet because it's not like they're all gone and signed elsewhere and you completely missed out at this point. So I think there are nervous moments a little bit in Seattle and among Seahawks fans, as there probably should be, because, you know, they've let a pretty good, you know, pass rushing market kind of go by the wayside and sign elsewhere. And so, you know, it just is kind of crazy that, you know, and you have no idea. They've done a pretty good job of keeping the negotiations pretty airtight and in the building. But, you know, is it Clowney unwilling to meet them at their price? Or are they unwilling to, have they put the number out there for him that he wants? And he's just trying to get more elsewhere. Who, you know, who really knows at this point? But at some point, the Seahawks have to come to the determination of, hey, we can't get left empty handed. That's not an option. So, you know, at some point, I wonder how long they leave their hat in the ring in the Clowney sweepstakes.
How likely do you think it is they turn to Everson Griffin if they can't get something done with Clowney soon? I mean, him and Pete Carroll go back to USC. His market's not the biggest one. He can be a bit cheaper. He had a good season. He's a bit older. Does he make more sense maybe?
I don't think he makes more sense, but he's certainly a nice fallback option. But I agree with you in that, like, the risk of losing both of them at some point means, like, okay, like, we would prefer Clowney, but, like, again, we can't be left empty-handed, so we got to go get Everson Griffin, and then we'll just move on, and, you know, we tried our best. So, you know, and again, I'm also of the thought of, like, we should, you know, the Seahawks shouldn't be, you know, playing this game of chicken with Clowney. If it's just over a couple million dollars, like, find a way to make it work, get the deal done, and get him under contract, right? You know, you don't worry so much about are we winning this deal, and worry about making sure your roster is where it needs to be heading into the draft, because I don't think this is something you want hanging over your roster, you know, when you go into the draft and even your pre-draft meetings, right? I mean, John Schneider is going to be really tied up over the course of the next couple weeks over FaceTime calls, essentially, with all the scouts scattered across the country trying to figure out, you know, the whole draft board and put that together and, you know, figure out where everyone's at. So, you know, that's already going to be such an extra challenge. I think the longer this goes on, the more distractions it causes.
So they hit such Joe Fan, our guest, Seahawks insider, NBC Sports Northwest, they hit such a home run with the Metcalf pick, not only in production, but, I mean, in future and fan favorite, all that kind of stuff. Does that make them, do you think, as an organization, more likely to go down the same road, take another swing on a receiver and see if you can't? I know they signed Dorsett, but this is a great receiving class. Are they more inclined to go that road because of the how well Metcalf worked out?
I don't know if that's necessarily what's going to push them that direction. It shouldn't hurt because you feel confident in your evaluation process at that position probably right now, you know, especially given how Tyler Lockett panned out. But, you know, they also swung and missed incredibly on Gary Jennings, who, you know, never even played a game for the team and ultimately got cut, and he was a fourth-round pick. And it's very rare that you see fourth-round picks cut in their first year. So I think it has more to do with, you know, you owe it to yourself, and every team does, to tap into this loaded receivers class and see, you know, if you can get one that ends up exploding. You know what I mean? I mean, there's so many great options, and you'll find them on day one, you'll find them on day two, and you'll find plenty lingering around in day three, you know? So I do believe this receivers class is as advertised. And so I think, yes, unless there's someone at another position that you just are so high on your board that you can't let go, I think you have to take at least one shot at this receivers class.
And what do you think they might do with the offensive line? We know it's been a big issue in Seattle for years. You do have Dwayne Brown, though, and, you know, they have something there. But at the same time, they got a couple centers now getting paid significant money, three guys actually at that position getting paid. Like, ultimately, do you think they might be looking to supplement that position in the draft? Or how do you think they feel about the mix with the offensive line?
Well, here's the deal. Like, you look at the Seahawks that they are now. Like, you could say, technically, they're good on the offensive line. They've got depth. They've got all the pieces in place. There's not a glaring hole that you're saying the Seahawks have to address this in the draft. However, they at some point, and it might be in the first round of this year's draft, they have to start looking forward at what their future is at tackle, because Dwayne Brown's about to be 36 before week one, and Brandon Shell, you know, might be a replacement-level guy, a tick better than the Fetty, but probably not your long-term option, right? He might be, but it's a two-year deal. It's pretty low budget. What was it? 2 years, $9 million, I think it was. So, like, he's not making a ton. Like, so you kind of you're budgeting your offensive line right now. But at some point, you have to have an idea of who is at least one of your tackles of the future. And right now, you don't have one. So I am of the belief that if some of those guys fall in the first round, that, you know, one, maybe they fall all the way to 27. But, you know, if not, if there's a guy you really like and he's hanging around in the early 20s, you might have to make a move to go up, because I do think, you know, this is a good draft to move up in, given, you know, the kind of screwy draft process with minimal pro days and meetings and all that. And then beyond that, you know, the lack of an off-season program and potentially a pared-down training camp. So rookies from the jump are going to be, you know, playing catch-up, you know, a bit. So yes, in the short term, no, the Seahawks don't need anything at the offensive line spots. But I think in the long term, it would behoove them to start looking down the road at what their answer is at tackle.
The division is arguably going to be the most competitive in football. San Fran is still going to be good. Seattle never takes a step back. And Arizona's been, you know, one of the talks of the offseason getting Hopkins. The Rams are a bit interesting. How do you view the division as a whole right now?
I mean, I thought it was the best division in football last year, and that's with Arizona almost beating the Niners twice, smoking Seattle once at home, and what was one of their worst home losses in quite some time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a strong division that's only gotten stronger. And, you know, did Arizona bump up their rebuild process to where they're immediate contenders? I think that's their plan, right? I mean, they still need pieces on defense. It was a defense that, outside of Chandler Jones, really struggled. Patrick Peterson wasn't himself last year, so what's he got left in him? Buda Baker, really talented player, but just didn't have everything put together. But again, they showed some flashes, and Kyler Murray looks like a total stud. Now you have Christian Kirk, Larry Fitzgerald, and DeAndre Hopkins, which, I mean, just the most absurd trade I think I've ever seen in my life. The Niners are still loaded, even though they lost to Forrest Buckner. You know what they have there. You know, and then the Rams still have a bunch of talent, but they're going through a weird time where they're coming off a really tough year. So how do they rebound, I think, is a big question mark. But, yeah, the NFC West, there's not going to be any gimmies there.
Well, there won't be, and it's so interesting to kind of see what else the Seahawks do this offseason, because it kind of seems like they always double down to be what they are, and they try to limit the amount of series and games and win on, you know, on the last possession, and they kind of like to grind their guys throughout the season and play the same style of football. And as much as people count them out every year, it seems like they find a way to at least win 10 games, and their bad season is 9-7 under Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson. Is the floor for the Seahawks still that as a team right now, that 9-7 type of team that might win 10 games? And do you think there's a chance they might be able to be the best team in that division, or is that too hard to do considering where San Fran's been at?
You always have a chance with Russell Wilson, you know, and you know, say what you want, Pete Carroll and the way he manages games, and I've been very critical of how he uses timeouts and his aggressiveness or lack thereof, but the man has a program that works, and it's 10 years in, and success speaks for itself. The wins speak for themselves. The playoff appearances speak for themselves. The playoff wins speak for themselves, right? So the combination of Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll gives you a baseline of 8-8, you know, just right off the top. And that's if you're suffering just massive injuries elsewhere. And you look at that team, you know, you could easily say that was an 8-8 team that somehow overachieved. You know, so I think they are set up right now, especially if you can get a pass rusher and maybe one or two impact rookies. You know, I think there's no reason why, you know, remember, they were balling their hands, a Malik Turner drop away potentially from winning that game in Green Bay and going to the NFC Championship game. So the margin is small. They're not that far away, if we're being totally honest, just because of what you have at the top of the roster. And it's nice when you have a floor that's as high as the Seahawks is.
Joe Fan is a Seahawks insider, NBC Sports Northwest. Thanks for this, Joe, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Hey, guys, thanks so much for having me. Take care of yourselves.
Joe Fan, NBC Sports Northwest. Do you agree with that? Is the division going to be the most competitive in football? I think the Rams are probably the most intriguing team to see where they fall.
Yeah, they've made a lot of changes. I'm not sure if they're still in a spot where, like, they'll be competitive because they've got obviously a really good coach, and the offensive line for the most part stayed intact, and you have Aaron Donald. I agree with what you're saying. It's going to be such a tough division to, you know, get to 12 wins for anyone in that division for next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be really tough to get to 12, but at the same time, like just what we talked about towards the end with Joe, like, the Hawks are always going to be that team that wins at least 9 games, or like at least wins 10 games. Like, I just don't see, no matter how flawed they are, that the floor of them is always in that range. And as Bick mentioned, if you're not quite sure there's a team that's good enough, considering how good the division is, or can separate enough to win 12 games, then would you want to bet against the Hawks that have been through that every single year of Russell Wilson's career?
Well, used to it now, as I say for the games, right? It applies to the season. Like, every season's the same now.
Yeah, and no, it is.
They're absolutely all different, but it's when you've got a juggernaut QB, you've got to give him the resources to try to keep getting shots to get to the Super Bowl. It's as tough as it is, and here's the thing about, like, firing a coach, is when you fire a coach, even in the offseason, you're basically punting the next season, too, because a new system comes in place, new defense, or whatever changes are being made, it's going to take time for a coach to establish all the principles he wants to put in and new players he wants to find to fit his systems. So when you do that, you're burning another year on an elite player. And that's one of the, you know, criticisms I have against the cult of people that are trying to call for Pete Carroll's job. It's okay, but then you're risking another year Russell Wilson potentially for a rebuild. And you have a decent marriage now, and you may as well just ride it out and hope they get it right come January.
That is not a good reason to stay in a marriage, Bick. That's decent. Better ride it out. Maybe
ride it
get
out.
Better.
You're no,
such,
why not?
You're like, such a you're such a romance.
It's not as if there's trouble spots, is what I'm saying. You're sacrificing for upside, which you don't know you're gonna get.
You're right. That, you know what? You shouldn't bail out of a marriage at the first sign of trouble either. You're correct.
One, there hasn't really been a lot of trouble. Like, there were, like, the Hawks
were what's trouble
going
9-7? Yeah. Like,
well,
yeah, that's not trouble.
I know, but it's still like, I couldn't bring myself to fire Pete Carroll either, but there is a lot of times where it really feels like they win in spite of Pete Carroll. And I'm sure that's...
Okay, let me put it to you this way, right?
I'm sure,
Packers won a Super Bowl, right? With Mike McCarthy, that was great. But it took so long for it to, like, disintegrate to what it was. And that only just happened last year.
Right, correct.
So are the Seahawks in the same stage? Like, do we look the Seahawks at the same way where the Packers were a year ago?
A little
like,
bit.
Like, this is the year where the floor caves in.
And they found, and it's never truly caved in for the Green Bay Packers. They did miss the playoffs, but
Rodgers got hurt. I mean, that's the main reason why they won four games or whatever that year.
But they also, you know, recognize. I mean, yes, McCarthy had a falling out with Rodgers, but they also, I think, identified Matt LaFleur as, hey, this is the guy that's gonna take over the next wave. And I do think Seattle. Pete Carroll's the oldest coach in the National Football League now. The Seattle Seahawks do have to keep an eye on what's next, don't they?
Well, they do, for sure. And I think that's something that will come up. But here's the thing. When the GM and the head coach have been tied to the hip for so long and worked so well for so long, there isn't exactly this urge from John Schneider to be like, yeah, bring the next guy in, because he's got something that's working as well. Like, that whole unit, and especially with Russell Wilson, like Wilson, Carroll, and Schneider are always aligned. And if you have those three aligned and they run your organization, like, it's pretty hard to break that up. Like, how do you break that up?
Yeah, no, true enough. I get it. But I feel like it's you know, it feels like they win so many games in spite of Pete Carroll sometimes. But I think...
Oh, I get it.
I think that's what every... Like, if you're a baseball fan, you get upset at your team because it's like, you should always get that runner in from third with less than two outs. Like, it's unexcusable, and good teams do that. Whereas I think it's like, we never, like, you know, it's one out and that guy struck out or popped out. We didn't get that runner in. I feel like every fan of every team feels like their team is the worst at getting runners in from third. Where in the reality
that's
is
team you watch all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
But the reality is like teams only do that at like a 50% rate. And it feels like it should be automatic anyway. Maybe it's the same in any NFL market.
Yeah, I think it is.
Other than New England, and even New England, I'm sure there's a pocket of Patriots fans that think he's overrated, and they're all Team Brady, and they should move on.
Well, I'm sure there are people that are saying the same thing, especially with how inactive they've been because of their cap situation. So I get it, and I'll say this about football too. One thing that gets overlooked a lot is if you have a head coach that gets the team to buy in and gets the team to perform, even if he makes mistakes, like, it's so hard to find coaches in the NFL that gets you this baseline of buy-in year in and year out. And as much as we judge X's and O's, and we should, that's the more important thing for NFL coaches, and Pete Carroll has that nailed, and that's why he's still employed.
Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah, it is the program. We're going to come back, and we're going to check in with one of our coworkers, our daily check-in segment. And another edition of the What If game when we come back, Sportsnet 650.
Welcome to the program with Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah.
And Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah. It's Justin Morissette back at the Sportsnet 650 headquarters, keeping us on the rails. And Bick Nizar joining us, our producer, from his palatial estate as well.
It's called the manor.
Right. It's called a hovel. Which bridge are you set up under today for the show?
Nizar Manor. That sounds pretty good.
So that crappy movie that I rented last night and paid $20 for, The Hunt, which is the $20 I'm never going to see again. I could watch it again tonight because, I rented it for 2 days. If y'all could watch it for free if you were able to come over, but there's the...
Can we go on FaceTime and then I can watch it through FaceTime?
Yeah, can you play it on Zoom maybe?
It's not worth it. But it's funny you say manor because these people get hunted at a manor and they keep calling it a manor, and what's her name, Hillary Swank, keeps – it's like – she's like, it's not a manor. It's just a house.
It's just a house.
I haven't heard the term – I love Hillary Swank. Like Hillary,
so that's
Hillary,
probably why you watched it.
Hillary Swank is kind of – now, I didn't make the rules of this, but she seems to be the patient zero for anybody's celebrity hot or not ranking. There's a big debate whether Hillary Swank is attractive or really not that attractive. And I think Hillary Swank is drop-dead gorgeous. She is right.
Is Agent Zero the right? Wouldn't it be the Mona Lisa, 50-50? The way you look at it kind of thing?
Yeah, I suppose. But there's a lot of people that oh, she looks like a horse, and I'm like, I think she's right up there for me. She's not my number one, but she's pretty close.
She's attractive, but she's super talented. I mean, did you?
Oh yes.
What was her boxing movie called again?
Million Dollar Baby.
I just watched it last week.
What would you like? I always enjoyed that movie. It had obviously a very sad ending, but I always thought it was great.
That was a very simp comment, by the way.
Why?
And she's very talented. Yes.
Well, she is. I was
going
to talk about that movie.
Yes, that's not what we're talking about.
She won an Academy Award for it.
Simp. Okay, simp.
Hey, man.
She's like a magic eye. Some people just can't see it.
Yeah, exactly. And not everyone's like that. Some people are just, you know, whether they're attractive or not. But she seems to be.
I bought so many of those books and they never worked for me.
I've never seen a magic eye, ever.
Just gotta unfocus your eyes.
Yeah, I know. Thanks. I know how they. I know what the theory is.
I've never heard that one before. You gotta look through the photo. Come on.
Is it a jackal? Is it a jackal? It's a jackal.
You either like something or you don't. That's it.
Okay, simp. I don't get to use that word very often when it's not.
You're
referring
so
to
proud.
Me. Yeah. Yes, I am. I am proud. I told you a week ago that was my new. That was my new word. Okay, it is, what time is it? 6:07. What day is it? We like to check in on our friends and our neighbors and our countrymen. Let's do that now, our daily checking in segment.
I'm checking in.
He's checking in.
I'm checking in.
Checking in. Our daily checking in segment, and we'd like to check in with someone that's working in our office or doing a show from home, one of our coworkers that we have not been able to see for quite some time. And we're checking in today with our friend Random Janda.
What's going on, boys?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing all right. How are you guys?
We're okay. How's your life? You're alone. You have nobody. You have nothing. How are you?
Yeah, very, very much like you in that regard. Yeah,
that's true. How are you coping? You have a Shoto or Shindo or whatever his name is.
Shoto, yeah, you have it right the first time. 13-year-old dog. He's chilling. He's all right. He's doing okay. I don't know, man. This has been tough for me, guys. I went from working on Saturdays all of a sudden to having a lot of free time. This has kind of hit me hard. Filling that free time hasn't been easy. I need suggestions, guys.
Yeah, you were doing a lot. So you were doing the Reach Deep with Reachio, but then you were also Hockey Night Punjabi, and that was every Saturday, basically all day. And you were doing the walk-off interviews for Canucks home games. So, yeah, you were a very busy guy.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with my life right now. So it's been a lot of kind of similar to what you guys have been doing. I've been listening to the show, you know, a lot of binge watching on Netflix, a lot of movies, having a drink or two, which is good in moderation. This time you don't want to overload the immune system either. But, like, I don't have any other hobbies. Yeah, no, honestly, I say this, but I'll probably have a drink in about 10 minutes after I'm done this.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, I went from doing a lot to all of a sudden just doing this show 4 to 7, right? And
yeah.
It's a lot different. Like, when you're working a lot, you're kind of like, yeah, you know, it'd be nice to have some time off. And then you have time off and you're at home all the time. You're like, you know, I'm good. Like, I'd rather go back to working, overworking than working less. But I do think, Randy, like, you got to come up with something to fill your time outside of watching shows, drinking, and whatever it is. Like, you got to come up with a hobby or something new.
So I got a couple things.
That's how you have to challenge yourself. Like, a puzzle, a jigsaw puzzle maybe, like, or painting. Like, you got to come up with something.
Oh, no, yeah, and I'm not doing the Joey Kenward, like, puzzles or birds or whatever.
Man, Joey Kenward does puzzles. We're not doing puzzles.
No, no, I'm not doing a puzzle. So I'm going for a run right after this, actually. So I'm going to do something productive, you know, just my social distancing, but maybe for, like, a, you know, a couple of kilometer run just to get the lungs going. And then I'm learning Spanish. That's continuing. I'm trying to be productive, you know. So I'm trying to learn something, guys.
Je m'appelle Randeep.
That's the other one.
That's French.
That's French.
It's me llamo, first of all.
Me llamo es por favor, cerveza.
Hey, he's from Saskatchewan. Give it time. You'll figure out which one's Spanish eventually.
That was the most Saskatchewan por favor I've ever heard in my life.
Por favor.
You know what? The thing.
Dos tequilas, por favor.
This is a guy that's also been to Cancun on the worst vacation ever, and that's the best Spanish you can do.
You know what? I actually, it's the gift that keeps on giving, because no matter how difficult this last few weeks have been, I'm sitting here, can't go outside, bored, can't see anyone or have anyone over, and I'm thinking, at least this was better than my Cancun vacation. It's true. So, like, it could always get worse.
You know what you missed out on? It should have been like a Firefest doc. Like, a camera crew went with you on that vacation. That would have sold millions of copies, man. Like, it would have been streamed online. Like, Firefest doc of your vacation.
Well, man, this sounds so silly, but I'm being serious. And it does sound like egocentric. But by the time the vacation was ending, and I think I told the story about, like, my last meal there before I boarded the plane, and just how, like, it was like an episode of Curb. Like, everything was going so poorly, and they couldn't bring me anything that I wanted off the menu. It was just a nightmare. I actually, for a split second, thought I was being punked. Like, I actually was looking for cameras. And I'm like, and I know it sounds like, oh yeah, you'd think someone would, like, that's how bad it was. I was looking around. I was like, I know Sportsnet doesn't have the budget for this, but did they send a camera just to, like, mess with me? That's how bad it was.
Listen, Rintel has clout. He doesn't have that much clout. He'd punk you that much.
Yeah, worst vacation ever. So, okay, so you're learning Spanish. Like, that's already, it's a lot. You're going for a run and you're learning Spanish. Everything else?
Yeah.
Anything else?
Reading. I've been binge-watching a lot of things. So I finished off Breaking Bad. I hadn't watched it. Yeah, I was one of those guys that was holding out. Finally watched it. I'm re-watching The Office now. So I'm mixing in a little few things, man. Mm. I've got a few things going.
So you finally watched Breaking Bad. All right, so now that you watch Breaking Bad, because you're a big fan of The Wire and also Sopranos, amazing shows.
Yep.
How do you, as a new connoisseur of Breaking Bad, how do you rate it in comparison to those shows?
Okay, so I like Breaking Bad. I think it's a great show. I think the character development of Jesse and Walter White is pretty awesome. But that slow build, and listen, The Wire is slow, The Sopranos are slow, but the writing in both of those shows, I think, is tier one, whereas Breaking Bad, to me, it's a tier two show. And I still stand by The Sopranos and The Wire being top two, based on the way they develop characters, the consistency throughout the shows. And Breaking Bad, to me, I understand, like, everything happens in season five, but if you're ranking the series, I think just from a consistency and the better writing, is those first two shows I mentioned with The Wire and The Sopranos.
See, I think you can say that those two shows are better. It's not in a tier below, though. Like, you can rank them above them in the same. Like, I think they're in the same tier. Like, to me, Breaking Bad is right there with The Wire, The Sopranos. I think Leftovers is an amazing show. I put that, like, as a top tier show. I think that tier is, those are all, those shows are there, but you can rank them above each other. But I can't take Breaking Bad being a second tier show. It's not second tier. It's
right there. And that's more to basically say how highly I think of The Wire and The Sopranos. Like I said, I think Breaking Bad's a great show, but depending on where you put it, what's a more comparable? I got to rewatch this show, but Mad Men is where I'm looking at Breaking Bad. Like that's the comment. Mad Men's a great show, and I got to rewatch it because I think when I watched it, you know, the second time you watch it, you give a little bit more credit and props to the show. But that's when I say tier one. Like I think The Wire and The Sopranos are the gold standard. Breaking Bad and Mad Men are probably that next level to me.
Have you watched the first couple seasons of Homeland?
Yeah, which are kind of like the same every season. It's like the same storyline.
Yeah. They can. It has repeated itself a bit, but I still think the first few seasons of Homeland are right up there. Maybe a little bit more unrealistic, but right up there for me in terms of TV that I could not turn away from.
Yeah, entertainment value. When you had I think it was Brody was the character's name. Like
that's right.
That was engaging television. I know the new season's out, but I haven't watched it. I think it fell off maybe after season four or whatever it is. But yeah, the first couple of seasons, that was, you wanted to watch every single episode for sure.
Have you guys watched Leftovers at all? Like,
I haven't.
You guys have. Have you?
I haven't. No.
No.
I've heard about it. And I've heard you talk about it before, Sat, but I haven't given it a chance yet.
It's a really good show. It's heavy. Like, the first season is a bit heavy. It has some slow developing moments, but the subject matter and the acting and the character development and the entire context of the show and what's happening, it's brilliant. You got to watch it, especially if you call yourselves big, you know, TV show guys and whatever. You got to see The Leftovers.
Never even heard of it.
Really?
I've never heard of it.
It's on Crave. Go on Crave and watch it.
What's the context?
So essentially, 10% of the world's population just disappears one day.
Oh, okay.
And everybody deals with the fallout of that.
Okay, interesting concept.
Yeah. Anything else, but that's kind of like enough. You know the concept of the show.
You're also a guy that thought Air Bud should win an Oscar, though.
Listen, why do you take away from the athleticism of that dog and the acting skills? Like, how many dogs can you train to do that? Come on. Like, that's an impressive acting job.
That's true.
I, for one, thought Most Valuable Primate was a great movie as well, right?
Do you guys remember, because we were talking about watching sports games and remembering how you watched it in the moment as a kid, and sometimes, like, you know, your team could do no wrong, or you watched it with like this childlike wonder. I feel the same way with movies. Like I came across a movie the other day and I didn't rewatch it, but do you remember the movie Homeward Bound?
Yes.
Yeah.
Michael J. Fox was one of the voices of one of the dogs, but it's basically two dogs and a cat that traverse themselves across the country to reunite themselves with their. And I who knows if it holds up? But I remember as a kid thinking that movie was pretty awesome.
It was. I don't know how it holds up, but yeah, man, I thought it was a great movie.
Well, honestly, any movie with animals these days, like Sat, I know you think this way, and Wax, you've had a Taco was a dog that you cared for a little bit, and then eventually Taco turned his back on you. But in a lot of ways,
that was accurate.
Okay, well, I thought that's how it went down. But any movie with animals, I'm down for. So it doesn't even have to hold up. As long as there's an animal in it, a dog's in it, I'm already sold.
He is Randeep Janda, Random Janda, on Reach Deep with Dan Riccio. Before we let you go, let's get into what will involve you in our daily What If segment. So let's get to that. What If? Let's do it right now.
A lot of things have happened in sports, but what if something else happened? It's the program What Ifs.
Bick Nizar comes up with the What Ifs. What are we kicking around today, Bick?
What if at the 2019 NHL entry draft held in Vancouver, what if the Vancouver Canucks traded for Tyson Barrie instead of JT Miller?
You guys leading off on this one? You want me to jump straight in?
My first
inclination is they would not be anywhere close to where they are because JT Miller was their best player.
I think what would have happened is they would have not made the JT Miller trade, of course, because that deal would have already been done. And I think they would have probably signed Gustav Nyquist as a free agent. And it would have been Tyson Berry and Gustav Nyquist instead of JT Miller and Tyler Myers.
Nyquist is a decent player. I mean, Columbus, he was having a decent enough year in Columbus for a team that doesn't score a whole lot, 15 goals, 42 points in 70 games.
Yeah, but I guess the question here is also, you know, you talk about Nyquist, he's a good player, but I think on the Vancouver Canucks, that fit of JT Miller, we can all acknowledge he's one of the best players, if not the best player, maybe along with Markstrom this season and Elias Pettersson, but I just start to wonder, the Tyson Berry fit to me, having watched, and you guys, you know, watched a lot of games on Saturday night too, with Mike Babcock, he struggled, he didn't get that opportunity, but I just wonder on that back end, you make that move, how much better are you? Because yes, there's a lot of naysayers, a lot of people that are critics of Tyler Myers and the way that he plays and the money he makes, but I still don't mind him. I know you guys have talked about how he's not as bad as some people like to make him out to be. I think this Tyson Berry, there was a lot of, you know, opportunities that he was given up in Toronto this year. I don't like the fit of that back end with Tyson Berry on it.
To be honest, I actually think, and I've defended Tyler Myers, I stand with Tyler Myers in general, but I think Tyson Berry's a better player overall. So I do think that if you substitute Myers for Berry, Berry's better than Myers, not significantly, but he is better. But Nyquist and Miller, that's a big gap to me. I mean, yeah. JT Miller didn't just play at a, hey, top six level. He was playing at an elite two-way Mark Stone impact Selke type of season. Like, that's how good he was. Like, without JT Miller and you swap those two guys out, the Canucks probably are not in a position that they're going out and getting Tyler Toffoli at the deadline, because they're probably not that close to a playoff spot, or at least they're not driving the same way they've been driving this season. Like, you can't underestimate the impact JT Miller has had in so many different ways. Like, I think if that happens, and maybe some will say in hindsight, it would have been better they don't go out and get Toffoli and give up a second round pick and Tyler Madden to get a rental, and who knows what happens now. But I don't think they're in a position that they even entertain making a deal like that if they don't have JT Miller.
Because you might be able to get the point production from Nyquist to a certain extent, but we know JT Miller is so much more than that, right? When he brings that physical presence, he brought that leadership, he kind of drags players in that lineup to play up, which, with all due respect to Gustav Nyquist, good player, but he ain't going to bring that. That's the, you know, that you talk about that gap. It's tangible, and there's also the intangible component when it comes to JT Miller.
Yeah, and JT Miller, again, is going to be a stalwart on this team for years at his contract. It's just, I can't say enough good things about that trade. It's to me, it's one of the better, and I know, like, trades used to be made more, and there was more blockbuster, and the cap wasn't such a big thing, but to me, in the cap era, it's one of the best trades the Vancouver Canucks have ever made. I mean, that's how highly I think of JT Miller. Any other scenario...
It's a really good trade.
Yeah, any other scenario, it's just, it's really difficult to see the Canucks being as good, where it's, hey, this sure. guy instead of Miller or Tyson Berry, or there's not a big difference between Myers and Berry. If anything, Myers is probably better defensively. And
I don't know. I think defensively they're pretty comparable, actually, and Tyson Berry does put up a lot of points. I think Tyson Berry probably gets the Tyler Myers treatment in Toronto, if that makes sense to some degree.
Yeah.
And he's actually more prolific as a scorer. So I think Berry is better, but there is some similarities in the perception of the two players and how they become
here.
The butt of everything.
But Quinn Hughes is also here. Tyson Berry's not
yes.
running the power play.
No. So that point production comes down to some degree. That's why I think that if you had made those deals, you're nowhere near a playoff spot. And then if you want to, you know, pull on the string a bit more, what does that mean then for this season? Like, imagine the Canucks get into a rut, like the pressure on the GM, the pressure on the coach all of a sudden. Like, the JT Miller thing was also about, it was a controversial move. People, you know, blasted it when it first happened. I was a bit, you know, sticker shocked at the price when it was made as well. But it worked out for them, and it's been seen as a really good trade. Even those that criticize it say, hey, the player's been high impact. Like, imagine if Benning doesn't have that on his resume and the team struggles.
Oh, for sure. And one other thing that we can maybe mention as well is that with Tyson Berry, you make that deal, you're probably looking at extension. What's his worth? With JT Miller, that trade, you've got him under control, right? So that's another win for Jim Benning. With Tyson Berry, you know, where's that valuation? right? How much are you going to pay him, and how does that change? Obviously, nobody predicted, oh, it happened with the cap now, but anytime you have to negotiate a new contract, that comes with its own complications.
But also, if we're playing this what-if game, because they signed Tyler Myers, where they would have traded for Berry, so in theory, unless they would have worked on it right away, in theory, Tyson Berry would not have had an extension. So they could have walked from Tyson Berry if they wanted to. And
they could have, but there was buzz that if a deal was going to be made, the Canucks and Berry were going to work out an extension. So it was going to be in that 6-7 year range.
And also, I mean, listen, the Canucks are in a more of a difficult cap situation. They can't just sign anybody they want. It could still be a wild offseason. We'll see. But Tyson Berry is still a guy that they could possibly go and get this offseason if they really wanted.
And cheaper, too, right? Because he's probably not going to get the contract he was looking for. But how about this for you guys? Let's say the Canucks had traded for Tyson Berry and given him a contract worth $7 million for 7 seasons. They gave Tyler Myers $6 million for 5 years.
Yeah.
Which one would you rather have on the books, given what's happening now with that money?
I'll say Myers.
I'm actually going to side with Walks on this one because I know Tyson Berry gives you a lot more upside offensively, but watching him in Toronto this year, there are some serious flaws in his defensive game. Yeah. Not to say Tyler Myers is perfect. He's got his own issues.
Sure.
But to me, Tyson Berry, to invest 7x7, we saw some flaws in his game this year that I didn't see in Colorado, and maybe that was the makeup and of that Colorado team. I've kind of soured on that Tyson Berry for big money.
But also, Sats made this point before, too. Like, the Canucks don't have a lot of problems scoring, so I kind of think sometimes, like, hey, is Tyson Berry kind of redundant here? But also, as we were getting later in the season, and you realize that the Canucks are at their best when they try to score a bunch and Jacob Markstrom plays well, like, that's their formula. So, I mean, unless you're bringing in a bona fide shutdown guy, and Tyler Myers is not that, I mean, who cares if Tyson Berry's a turnstile, if you have Markstrom on one side of the ice and then you're just trying to score 5 or 6 a night on the other side, maybe that is your formula.
Yeah, I kind of think that as much as we talked so much about the Canucks not needing to go and get a player like Tyson Berry, on the third pair, like if you looked at each pairing and how things worked out, they were lacking another guy that could move the puck well and skates the puck well out of his own zone. Yeah, you want guys that can defend better in your own zone too, but you're right. Like the Canucks were at their best when they were pushing the pace, when they were trying to create chances. And if you can get enough players that create far more than they give up, then it doesn't matter if you give up a high number of chances. It's a new wave of the way hockey is going. But as much as I, you know, don't mind, you know, I like Tyson Berry and think he's better than Myers, I think now because of what's happened with the pandemic and who knows how much the cap may rise or may go down the next few years, like having that extra 2 years on the books and $1 million more per year, like that makes a big difference right now. Like I think at this point we're in a situation where every single dollar on the cap is going to mean so much more than we ever anticipated for the next few years.
When we come back, we're going to get into the isolation mailbag and also our shout-outs for the top of the hour. Randeep, gracias por tu tiempo.
Yes. I'm glad I could give you my time as well. I got that.
Yes.
Thank you. And hey, I just wanted to, before I leave here, I wanted to give you guys a shout-out for starting the Essential Workers shout-outs as well. That's awesome for you guys. So, you know, 650-650 on the text line, get those in. That's awesome. Good for you guys.
Grassy ass.
Pardon?
Thanks.
You just swore at me as well.
Thanks,
guys.
Thanks, Randy.
That is Randeep Janda from Reach Deep. And yes, I'm glad I thought of the shout-outs. I'm a pretty...
That's actually exciting.
You know what? I'm a pretty good guy.
Taking credit for other people's work?
Yes. No, it was Bic Nazar's handiwork. 650-650 is the Subway text line. The isolation mailbag is coming up. Ask us anything, sports, non-sports, make it as stupid as you want on the Subway text line. And yes, if you know somebody that you think we should give a little love to, shout-outs coming up before 7 p.m., 650-650 to get your names in. Tell us your story, and we'll give them some love. Before the end of the show. Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah. It is the program, Sportsnet 650.
Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Boseman. Wait, hey.
Now more of the program with Andrew Walker and Satyar Shah.
It is Andrew Walker. It is Satyar Shah. NVR un Correo. That is that is mailing a letter in Spanish. Because I speak I'm also learning Spanish along with Randy.
You're teaching yourself. What did you use? Google Translate?
Basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah, Bik Nizar, and Justin Morissette with us as well as the program continues. 650-650 is the Subway text line. Get us your shout-outs in because before the top of the hour, we're going to give the shout-outs to whoever you think deserves them. Obviously, at 7 p.m., the city celebrates our frontline healthcare workers, and we dedicate the last few minutes of our show to giving out those shout-outs. So give us a text, 650-650. Tell us the name, tell us their story, and we'll give them some love before the show is out. But first, it is one of our favorite times of the day. It is the daily isolation mailbag. Still time to get in your questions, 650-650. Bik, what are the good people texting in today?
All right. We will start with Seth, 650-650. Now that you're home 24/7 and using everything in your house, what have you noticed that you aren't using it at all?
I don't use my oven. Ever.
No?
Ever. Yeah, that's a pretty big one.
You can't just, like, discard your oven, though.
No, but I don't use it. I use my stovetop and I use my barbecue and I use my microwave. I literally never use my oven, ever.
What do I have that I don't use? Like, honestly, nowadays, I have video games. Like, I talked about perhaps playing some video games. Like, right. I have some video games. I have a PS4. I've played maybe 30 minutes overall since we've been at home.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, maybe that's it.
I didn't notice yesterday as I was doing the dishes. I have a potato masher. No idea why. I've never, ever used it. It's like almost in its wrapping still. That's probably the only thing other than the oven. That was a good answer.
Yeah, but a potato masher? Yeah, I guess, I mean, if you're a single guy living on your own, I mean, how often are you making mashed potatoes?
Like a turkey baster.
I don't even know when I got it or why I have it.
I'm trying to think. You know what? I have. I'm looking right now. Coasters. Like, I have coasters, but I don't use them because I have like a glass kitchen table and not kitchen table. Sorry, a glass living room like coffee table. I don't use the coasters because I'll just clean the table if I need to. I don't know.
See, it's the sign of everything falling apart. In 2 months, we would be like, utensils. Who uses utensils? We just shove things in our face.
Just eat it with your hands. Eat that soup with your hands.
Like, I have, like, does clothes count? Like, the amount of clothes I have that I don't wear nowadays? Like, it's like the same thing every single day.
Yeah, I have on my my Adidas sweats and my neutral vodka soda hoodie. Everything else fits into that category. Literally everything.
It's funny because I did go, this was early March. I actually went shopping. It was late February. I actually went shopping, got a bunch of shirts and pants and stuff like that, and they all still have the tags on them.
You can take them back for refunds.
Not at this. I don't think anybody wants me near anybody.
I think that makes you an influencer. It's like, oh, I've got too many clothes.
Got too many clothes. Yeah, exactly.
I still, one of my projects before the end of this, I still have to go through and spring clean my clothes. There's a lot of stuff that you may as well just donate because I'm not going to wear them.
Marie Kondo, man.
Yeah, there you go. I was just going to say. Shiloh, 650-650. Will Walker shave ads into his head, and for how much?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Name your price. Oh, I'll shave ads into my... I mean, I don't know.
I've got zero issue being a walking billboard.
Get a tattoo on your forehead. How much would you...
In this economy, you'll do anything.
No, but like, what are clothes? You're basically a walking billboard. All these people with like fancy things along their legs and their torsos of brands. It's like you're just a walking billboard.
brand names.
You're paying for the right to be a billboard. It's crazy.
What would you take? I'll say it's a temporary tattoo for 1 year, and it's for Navaj.
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 Okay, where do we put the tattoo?
Right in your forehead. Navaj. For 1 year.
For 1 year
starting today. So the first few months are even in quarantine, so you save. So 1 year starting today. Navaj on your forehead. How much?
It's got to be 8 figures. Like, I'm not a tattoo guy at all.
It's only for a year, though.
No, I know.
It's like
8 figures.
20
so,
million, maybe.
Dude,
oh, come
like,
on.
I'm not a tattoo person at all. And like to get it on, if I was ever going to get
a
tattoo,
it's not about being a tattoo person.
Not going to get it on my hands, neck, or head. And so now you're saying right on my forehead. Like it's going to have to be excessive.
I would do it for $1 million.
I am way too vain to do that. Like I there's no way.
We know.
You know what? I would do it. I would do it for $500,000.
$500,000.
Yeah, it's only for a year.
Okay, still, you'll never live that down. You'll always be like, people don't forget. Like, this is super bad. Like, you'll always be the Navaj on the forehead guy.
No, but I'm not going on the panel. I'm not going on the panel with Murph. Like, I'm not going out and around town or anything like that.
But here's how you gotta treat it. How much is your time worth, right? And so think of all the conversations you're going to have down the street. Everyone's like, excuse me, do you know you have Navaj tattooed on your head? And if that takes 3 minutes to explain it every time, you're going to have to do that like 100,000 times.
No, the thing is, you can't wear a hat, right? Because like it's part of the advertisement, so you have to like display it proudly.
We never have a technicality
and wearing toques every day.
We never discuss those ramifications. I put it this way.
I'd
give up a year of my life, just kind of like I'm doing right now. It's to work and it's to home, and I'm doing it for $500,000, which kind of sets me up for, you know, a good chunk of the rest of my life. And listen, you guys would give it to me for weeks at work, but then you just get used to it. Like, then you would actually just get used to Navaj on my forehead. And so you'd stop bugging me, and we'd just continue going about our day, and then in a year I get to take it off.
We'd give you the stupid like hockey nickname like Navi, so we'd never forget.
Would you be allowed to like wear a bandana or something?
No, that's, you can't cover that, it.
No, that's even worse. I'd rather have the tattoo. I feel like if I went on a date, I'd have to answer less questions if I had Navaj on my forehead than if I came wearing a bandana.
Like in the office when he goes like Prison Mike.
Yeah, definitely. You guys can make fun of me all you want as I bring caviar and foie gras for lunch.
So, because that was
rich.
Very pretentious of you, by the way.
I'm rich.
This text from Silver and Black Canuck 650-650 Subway text line. Walker, how much does Adam have to pay you to one, tattoo Key West Ford somewhere visible, or two, have KWF shaved onto your head?
I would do that for free for my good friends at Key West Ford.
Oh, look at you. Jim says the argument doesn't work. You can't expect to get a premium for your forehead and then go into hiding. Yeah, you have to display it proudly. Like you probably have to hit a certain amount of time in public every day. Like you got to go in the corner of Robson and like, you know, Thurlow or like whatever. Just stand there and just like greet people every day.
Okay.
Unsigned text of 650-650. You can play a game of pickup hockey with any 5 players. One of them has to be a goalie. Any players from any area, from any era, who you got?
Pickup hockey.
Okay, I mean, we could just draft this out right now. It's 12 picks.
So our teams play each other?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think in a game of pickup, Mario would be like the most unstoppable.
Yeah, you gotta have Mario in a game of pickup. Mario, Bobby Orr. Get Obi? Dominic Hasek because you need somebody making crazy saves.
Oh, yeah. Hasek could be the best pickup goalie for sure. Paul Coffey.
Right. And probably Nick Lidstrom because you need somebody who's an adult.
The Sedins because the two guys.
Oh, that
work,
would be kind
together.
Of sneaky good.
Yeah, sneaky
yeah.
good.
Oh, and yeah. Sedins, Mario, and, Bobby Orr, and Lidstrom, and Hasek. Let's go.
Yeah, let's go.
Todd, 650, where do you want to retire? That was a good question.
where do I want to retire?
Where do I want to retire?
That's a great question. Okay,
I have a dream. I've always had this dream of retiring in a fairly big acreage so I can have as many dogs as I want and set up my own rescue by the water, either by like Lions Bay or along the way to Whistler or like Sunshine Coast or something. That's what I want to do.
Right. And because, yeah, you couldn't be like Aruba because you love sports too much. You couldn't live isolated in like some beach country. You couldn't.
No, it has to be like, it has to be BC because I love BC. It has to be somewhere relatively close that every once in a while when I got a hankering, I can go watch a game or something. You know, be close.
Right. I want to retire on like Mars, like the, like wherever we colonize.
You said you don't want to travel to Mars the other day.
Yeah,
you didn't want the wall one-way ticket to Mars.
One-way ticket.
Well, I changed my mind. I'm allowed to do that, am I not?
That's true. You have a lot of time to ponder things, so you've had a lot of time to consider between yesterday and today.
Katie, 650, what would you name your boat if you had one?
what would I name the Navage?
Navage.
What would I? Yeah.
How much do you pay me to name my boat?
Boat names are always really pretentious.
Yeah, they are, right? Like
boat
they,
names.
Like success or something.
No, you know what? I'd say I'd name my boat the one that got away with the initials of a long lost crush that may or may not be in our city right now. Anyway, anyway.
yes. yes.
That's a good answer. Let's go with that one. Tony's, the one last one. Tony, 650. What is the dumbest way you've been injured? Oh, I don't even want to share mine.
Goodness. When I was in high school, I was running like up the beach with a buddy. It was like a high school trip, and we tried to like recreate a Baywatch scene for someone's cameras, and we kind of tripped over each other, and I kicked him in the shin, and I broke like three toes. That was probably the stupidest.
I ran into a door once. That was pretty dumb, and I busted my head open. I had to get stitches.
Like a glass window, like you thought was open.
No, like a white bedroom door. I just ran straight into it, like to the the door was kind of ajar a little bit, so I ran into the edge of the door. I just had my head down, turned around and ran. I boom right into the door, and I like.
Were you trying to run away
open.
From someone? What's going on here?
Was no, I don't know what I was doing. I was excited to run into my room and grab something, and I just wasn't paying attention. I ran into the door. That was the dumbest injury I can remember.
What about you, Ben?
So I used to work in a warehouse, and from the second floor, a rack of tires fell over, and one tire went through the railing and landed around my neck. It was straight out of a cartoon, basically. and actually, I was like severely hurt. I was like concussions, everything for a significant amount of time. But I can laugh about it because like it's the amount of things that had to go wrong for that to happen all happened.
It was like, yeah, the opposite of Mr. Magoo. You know what I would have said to you, Sat, as you ran into the door?
What?
Cuidado con la puerta.
What?
Which means look out for the door in Spanish.
Very good. Hey, we got a last second write-in question to our Subway text line. Why was Alan interviewed in the bath during Tiger King?
I don't know. That threw me off too. So bizarre.
Weird.
Yeah, so weird.
I bet you he was totally high, and he's like, "I'm going to do this interview from the bathtub." And they're like, Okay.
Yeah, that guy was bizarre. All right, let's get to our shout-outs as we're creeping up until 7 p.m. Of course, 7 p.m., everyone is outside paying tribute to our frontline healthcare workers. 650-650, if you want to get your story out there or someone to give a shout-out to. First up, this one comes in, 650-650, the Subway text line. Just wanted to shout-out my brother Mike, who works in law enforcement, my nurse, sister-in-law Jess, and the amazing ECEs that care for their children so they can continue to serve our community. Also want to shout out my fellow social workers that work in healthcare or with other vulnerable people and children. Your work is meaningful. That from Nicole. Thanks, Nicole.
And this one from Pete. My wife and her coworkers who do lab work and analyze, they're drained and stressed out, but do the best work they can do. We appreciate them. Thank you, Pete, for sending that in.
Leslie, who is all the way out in Scarborough, Ontario, and listening online tonight, she says, huge shout-out to all the nurses, doctors, first responders, and grocery store clerks as well. Be safe, guys.
And this one from Silver and Black Canuck, shout-out to Clemente, the custodian at my work, keeping us safe by keeping us clean. All custodians are the real unsung heroes at any workplace, though. That is from Silver and Black Canuck. And, yeah, thank you to all our workers. And this isn't just about healthcare workers who are absolute heroes. It's others as well that are giving us the essentials we need right now.
Yeah, well said. We do shout-outs every day before the end of the show. 650-650 is the Subway text line. We'll be back on your Friday as well. Andrew Walker, Satyar Shah, Bick Nizar, and Justin Morissette back at Sportsnet 650. Have a great evening. Coming up tonight on Sportsnet, it was one of the final games of the Canucks season, that big 9-3 win on a Saturday night over the Boston Bruins. You can hear that next with Batch and Hershey on Canucks Rewind on Sportsnet 650. We'll talk to you tomorrow.